decides where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you? Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. I'm going to talk about what's going on in places like Detroit, where they have evidently going to file bankruptcy, filing Chapter 9. The city claims it doesn't have any money. And to me, deindustrialization, globalization, all of these insane trade policies, and of course, beggar thy neighbor, economic development, a lot to do with all this. But the real prize in this for the wealth class, well, if they can screw those workers out of their pensions, oh boy, will they be thrilled. Also going to talk about what's going on down in Florida as some activists, some protesters are staging a sit-in right now to get Governor Rick Scott's attention. And as I understand, there's going to be a meeting. We're hoping to get someone from the sit-in this evening as things go forward. It'll be interesting to see how that goes. Also going to talk about guns, and of course, more guns. Your thoughts, questions, comments, whatever's on your mind, you can give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. You can email me, Rick, at therickssmithshow.com. But here in Pennsylvania, some good news on the, good news for seniors anyway. The Pennsylvania Lottery released some numbers, had another record-breaking year. A record high ticket sales, more than $218 million over the previous year. The sales hit right about $3.69 billion last year, produced over $1 billion in profit. And we're gonna hack that off. Nice. According to the Department of Revenue, profits grew by $6.5 million over the previous year. Over $1 billion in profit. Now, no one knows if the $3 million that our governor has wasted exploring the outsourcing of the lottery's management, we don't know if that $3 million is anywhere in there. I would kind of guess maybe it's not, but we shall see. The year-end sales reports, and this, you can't make this up. And this is one of those things that makes me go, we're going to privatize the lottery. Why? And this is what the right runs from. This is what scares the right when you realize that the government does run efficiently. In fact, the administrative costs for running the Pennsylvania Lottery, lowest in the nation, decreased to 2.07% from 2.1%. Now, if I remember the hearing that the Camelot Global CEO talked about, the presentation that they gave that put operation costs, the administrative costs, at around 4%. Explain to me why that's a good idea. Explain to me why it's a good idea that we privatize something only to have it cost double what we're doing now. I know, it's just ideology. There should be nothing in the hands of we the people, right? I mean, because that's the only rationale, right? When I look at this and I go, okay, we're going to privatize it, and then we're going to give them a whole bunch of stuff that we're not willing to do, like the Keno and a whole bunch of other gambling, and, of course, saturation. Because if you listen to the hearing, and I know it's been a while since we've really talked about the Camelot Global thing, because, you know, some people think that the privatization of the lottery is dead. It's not. It's not. In fact, the original agreement was valid only through the end of last year, through the 31st of December. But there have been seven extensions. They've extended, and the latest extension goes through the end of this month. And listen, they're going to keep extending this until they get it. Camelot Global is not going to walk away from billions of dollars. Understand, the Pennsylvania Lottery, since its inception back in 1971, has raised nearly $23.7 billion. That's $27.3 billion in profit that went into senior programs. That is a lot of profit. And if they could only get a couple of percent of that, what a boom for them. I mean, it's a screw job for you and me, but a boom for them. Huge profits, bonuses. Oh, man, it would be corporate wet dream. And what do they want to do if we give them our lottery to run? Well, you're talking about saturation. They talked about how in the UK, when they took it over, they expanded the number of people playing and it had more. We could do that if that were good for society. We could open up Keno if we wanted to. I don't know that you give a brand new product away and go, okay, fine, take the revenue. Because I'm of the mindset that every dollar we don't put into senior programs is a failure of this lottery. If you allow this privateer to come in and you allow this private company to come in and suck money out of the program, you're screwing the seniors. Now, of the money spent out, prize money was $2.3 billion in prizes, about 62% of the revenue, about 62 cents out of every dollar. Now, I go back and I remember the hearing. It was about half. Now, if I remember the numbers right, it was about half in the UK. It's about 50%. So that 12 cents in prize money that went into your pockets because you played the game, that will evaporate. And that's going to go into the pockets of, well, the global company. Because they're not called Compass Global for nothing. Or Camelot Global. Now, what they've promised is to generate $34.6 billion in profits over the next 20 years. That's about $3 to $4 billion more than they claim the lottery will produce if you keep the management with the people who are doing it now. But that's kind of a wrong number, because that doesn't take into account expanding into Keno. The $34.6 billion in profit over the next 20 years from Camelot does. And I have to believe that if you open up other products, other games, other things, and you expand, it's going to be much more than that. So where does that money go? You know where it goes. I mean, we've seen this gig before, which is why they are fighting for it, which is why they're spending so much money and greasing the palms of people like Corbett. But you know the good thing? The good thing is you and me and the rest of us get it, which is why the governor's numbers are in the tank, which is why one-term Tom, 24% approval rating, is basically... I don't know if it's him sweeping the deck with all of his staff, or it's they realize that he's going down and they're jumping ship. Either way, you're seeing a mass exodus. You're seeing people leaving. And you look at, we talked about the guy who was the chief of staff. Only there a year, he's bailed. And what they do, they're bringing in an insider. They're bringing in one of the Ridge people. And that's what you're going to see. You're going to see the Ridge people coming back to try and salvage what's left of this guy. I don't know that it's going to help. Maybe Rick Santorum will throw his hat into the ring and run against one-term Tom. I don't know. But at the end of the day, it's you and I who are getting screwed in this. Think of all the policies that they've put forth. Think of all of the things that this guy has done, the agenda that he's pursued, and what it's gotten us. We are now one of the worst states in job creation. We were 7th down to 47th. In fact, last month I'm told we were the worst. Jobs are fleeing the state. Why? They're walking away from education. The infrastructure. No transportation bill. That tells me there's no commitment to the future. If I'm an employer, if I'm a guy who's got a business, I'm not coming here. I'm not coming here because you got to worry about a crumbling infrastructure, crumbling roads and bridges and education. And he's a guy who didn't take the Medicaid expansion, which means you got to wonder what's going to happen to the healthcare system in this state. A lot of stuff this guy's done to you just leaves you scratching your head. But his key achievements, like the voter suppression law, where we find out almost 15% of the people in this Commonwealth don't have an acceptable ID under their law. A law, mind you, that they say would stop nobody from voting illegally. And that there's never been anyone that would have been stopped by this. I mean, think about that. Think about the gravity of that statement. Think about when the Commonwealth says we've never found a case that could have been stopped by people having an ID. We don't know of any prosecutions in the works, and we don't know that it would stop anything, but it's our right to do. Think about that for a minute. And then think about the extremely conservative number of 511,000 voters, legally registered voters in this state who they're going to be turned away if this law is upheld. As we found out last night, that number could be as high as 1.8 million. Do you think that's in line with candidate Corbett's statement that if they could just hold down the vote in Philadelphia, that it would help him? Do you think that played on their minds when they were gerrymandering the district? Do you think any of this played into place? Yeah, I read an article this morning. From the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, written by a young woman named Megan Rogers. And, she did a very reasonable, a very good job just laying out the facts of this voter suppression, this voter ID trial. And she went through and talked about, the former judge and, some of the things in that. And it's not so much the article that caught my attention as who Ms. Rogers is. This, to me, is an extraordinarily serious case. This is something that I think is core to the fabric of our nation. And the Post Gazette had an intern with the Pennsylvania Legislative Correspondents Association write the article, a summer intern. I guess that just maybe it's just me, but it shows me how much the wealth class of this country. How much they care. How much they think of this. You can have an intern do it. I don't know. Anyway, good news today out of the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania. And we're going to talk a little bit about this in the next segment. But I wanted to get to it a little bit. The Commonwealth Court, the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania, they issued a temporary injunction against Corbett's plan to close up the Department of Health state health centers. There are a bunch of them. And his plan was to shut them down, and you go, I guess 26 health centers would be shut down. You'd have a bunch of nurses who would be kicked to the curb. And I look at this and I go, well, what happens to those people? And, then you go back and you remember one of Corbett's very first acts as governor was to kick some 41,000 working people off of adult basic, a very minimal, extraordinarily minimal health insurance plan that only had a handful of doctor visits, but it provided working people. These are people who work. These are the working poor. These are the low-wage workers who are taking care of our parents and feeding us and doing all. Strip that away from them. And then market-based solution gave them something, an option in the private sector that would have cost them four times as much, which they can't afford. And then you fast forward a little bit forward from that, kicks 88,000 kids off of the CHIP program. So is it surprising that he has no problem closing the state health centers and kicking 26 nurses to the curb? No. The good thing, those 26 nurses, they were represented by a union. and that union went to court and got that injunction today. And when we come back, we're going to talk about that with a representative from SEIU, HCPA. Going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. I'm The Talk.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka says a shimmer of light has broken through Republican obstructionism in the U.S. Senate with a deal to move forward on votes for some of President Obama's nominees. In a statement, Trumka said, quote, "A confirmed National Labor Relations Board will provide millions of workers with real protection of their rights to organize and bargain with their employers," end quote. But the price of moving to votes on the other nominees was the withdrawal of two of Obama's current nominees for the National Labor Relations Board, Sharon Block and Richard Griffin. Hundreds of residents of Chicago's Brighton Park neighborhood met Wednesday to voice concerns over school budget cuts and school closings. The residents are concerned about these cuts and want the budget restored. Patrick Brosnan is executive director of Chicago's Brighton Park Neighborhood Council. He says Mayor Rahm Emanuel should make finding enough money for public education a priority.
But at the same time that they're declaring these budget cuts, Rahm Emanuel is saying that they're going to give almost $100 million to public dollars to finance a basketball stadium for DePaul University. It's crazy. So the argument that there's no money is a false one. There is plenty of money. This is about priorities.
The National Association of Professional Law State Agents, NAPAA, affiliated with the labor union, OPEIU, is supporting a former Allstate insurance agent to determine if the company willfully violated state statutes in Minnesota in its attempts to terminate him and other Allstate agents in that state. Jerry Dulesky, a former Allstate agent, filed suit charging that the insurance company violated a Minnesota law and illegally expelled him. The Minnesota Department of Commerce investigated Allstate over Dulesky's dismissal and charged that Allstate had violated the statute. The National Association of Professional Allstate Agents says that Allstate agreed to pay a $5,000 civil penalty in lieu of facing formal proceedings on the charges. Jim Fish, executive director of the association, says that nationally the struggle continues as Allstate agents organize to improve their work lives at Allstate.
You know, you see in every labor management type of situation, Allstate likes to pretend that we don't exist, but, you know, obviously we do, and we let them know about it from time to time.
New York State is predicting lower health care premiums for individuals who purchase on their own. In a Wednesday announcement, Governor Andrew Cuomo said rates could drop as much as 50% on average, thanks to competition through an exchange New York created under the Affordable Care Act. There will be a number of plans to choose from, and the cost of each plan will be determined by what is offered as well as annual earnings. The drop in insurance rates won't impact individuals who receive insurance through an employer. However, tax credits are being made available for small business owners.
The Workers Independent News is brought to you with support from the Bank of Labor, a division of Brotherhood Bank and Trust, member FDIC, equal opportunity lender. Union-owned, union-represented Bank of Labor offers a business Visa card with no annual fee and points earned with every purchase, along with rental vehicle and travel accident insurance. Online at bankoflabor.com.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Every now and then, I visit an elementary school. Talking with children is a pretty good idea, I think. They ask questions we don't think about, and they ask them very directly. Recently, a little girl wanted to know, "What's the hardest part of your job?" That got me thinking. I looked down and I told her, "The hardest part is telling people no."
The hardest part of his job, saying no. I got to be honest with you. I think he does it fairly well. No, you low-wage workers, no, you're not going to get health care. No, you children who don't have health care because your parents' jobs don't provide it. No, you can't have health care. No, kids. No, there's not going to be funding for education. No, college students, we're not going to fund higher ed. And no, communities, we're not going to keep opening community health centers. Nope, not going to do it. Well, fortunately, the news came today that the Pennsylvania Supreme Court has issued a temporary injunction. And here to talk a little bit about that is Kevin Hefty. He's the vice president of SEIU Healthcare Pennsylvania. Kevin, thanks for taking time for us. Kevin evidently hung up. didn't want to get involved in that. No, look, I mean, you look at this, and as I understand it, the state has already closed some three of the health clinics, have gotten rid of 18 nurses at this point. They'd already, even before the hearing was over, they had already closed a number of these health services. Kevin, thanks for sticking around for us. Did we lose him again?
Nope, I'm here. Thank you for having me.
I appreciate you taking time for us. Explain this to me. What exactly is the governor trying to do? What's the rationale behind closing these 26 community health centers?
So, yeah, what they're doing is, you know, they're closing health centers around the state, mostly in rural counties. And, you know, their rationale, they call it modernizing, but, you know, the reality is they're cutting services, and it's an excuse to cut back on health coverage for people in rural areas.
So hold on, modernizing in rural areas where there's probably nothing else. Modernizing, does that mean just die?
So, you know, what their claim is that they will, you know, they'll locate the people who work in, say, for example, the Blair County Health Center is being closed, and the people there are going to be based out of Huntington. And so what they say is, well, you can work out of the Huntington office and still cover Blair County. But the reality is, you know, people in Blair County, you're not going to drive, you know, it's difficult to drive to Huntington for services. It makes no sense to, you know, close a health center in a county with, you know, double the population or more, you know, and located in Huntington. And, you know, and the reality is, as since they've done that, you know, their claim is, well, you know, we had a, you know, we did immunizations at the farm show, and that worked really well. Well, that might work well for, you know, that one event, but that's not a strategy for public health for the state of Pennsylvania. Is, well, we did it once at the farm show.
Yeah, I'm with you. But, you know, I guess the first question I have on this is, who uses these health clinics?
So it's a wide range of people. You know, so public health services, it could be, you know, you get a dog bite and you want to know, you know, do I have rabies and what do I do about it? You call your local, you know, your public health center. You have college students getting tested for venereal disease. You have parents who want to know what immunizations their children need before they go back to school. They do outreach to migrant farm workers. They do outreach to the Amish to make sure that they're getting their vaccinations. It's, you know, a whole host of, public health, you know, issues. And it's also, you know, when there's, you know, a disease outbreak or, you know, food poisoning. You know, the classic example was when, you know, there was hepatitis outbreaks from people who, you know, ate at Chi Chi's restaurants in Beaver County. You know, it was the public health nurses from the local state health center who went out and investigated, you know, so who ate in this restaurant? Let's track them down. Let's find them at their homes. Let's let them know that they were exposed. Make sure we test them for hepatitis and make sure that they get treatment.
So what happens if these get, fortunately, the Supreme Court of the Commonwealth, temporary injunction, I don't know how long that's going to last, and I'm sure that's something for down the road, but what happens when these, if these go away, if this isn't allowed to, if this doesn't continue, what happens to those people that need these services? What happens to those communities?
Yeah, so they're not going to get the same level of service, and it cuts the relationships between the people who serve that county. So, you know, for example, you know, if your job is to go out and talk to the Amish about getting immunizations, you know, clearly that's the, you know, being a stranger is not helpful to do that work. So you
Good
have
point.
Nurses who are based in, say, for example, Snyder County. So they get to know the Amish in their county. They get to know the elders. You know, when someone has, you know, has a child, you know, the elders say, hey, you know, this is the nurse. We'll introduce you. They get to know them. They have an in. You know, now, Snyder County Health Center has been closed. They're going to be based out of Northumberland. You know, that nurse may or may not go back to Snyder County, or maybe it's someone, you know, from the Snyder County, just the Northumberland County office who's supposed to go out for that day and, you know, drive around, randomly find an Amish family and persuade them to, you know, let you vaccinate their kids. Well, that's not going to happen. And so it means that, you know, fewer people will get vaccinated, and it, you know, it causes a public concern.
So what you could make the argument is what they're doing is very minimal short-term savings, even if they save anything, with the potential of massive long-term liabilities.
Yeah. I mean, you know, in Beaver County, it's like you get, you know, when the hepatitis outbreak, you know, came out at Chi-Chi's, you know, it resulted in two people needing liver transplants. You know, the amount of money that they save, you know, on, you know, rent in an office building, it's like one liver transplant will wipe that out. And a few serious illnesses will wipe out any savings. Like, it really is true that a, you know, an ounce of prevention leads to a pound of, you know, saves a pound of cure.
We used to know that stuff. You know, we used to understand that if you fix something right now, if you take care of it now, it doesn't turn into a massive problem. But I look at our current politic, and it seems like it's all about the short term victory, the short term savings, and not even concerned about the future. And I don't know how you go and you say, well, you know what, we're gonna shut these down in areas that, you know, are underserved already, in my view. As I was looking through some of the counties, I'm not imagining that there are an awful lot of options for people to choose from in a lot of these counties.
No. They're lucky if they have one hospital. You know, it's a place where, you know, they're in need of primary care physicians, they're in need of health care options. You know, they also happen to have a lot of uninsured, and the rural areas where people they already have to travel far just to get to the current state health center. If you live in, you know, rural Snyder County and now you have to drive to Northumberland, you know, like, that's a trek. It makes it that much less likely that you're going to go for services.
Yeah, I got to be honest with you, though, Kevin. You know, I look at this governor and his track record with the adult basic and with kicking the kids off a chip not too long ago, and this and not taking the Medicaid expansion money. I look at it and I say, you know, here's a guy who I don't know that he really cares about the mass of residents of Pennsylvania, especially those at the bottom end of the economic scale.
Yeah, I mean, it used to be women and children first meant helping them first, not cutting them first. You know, when they eliminated district health physicians, the consultants that they eliminated were the school board consultants and the maternal child health consultants. Those positions were eliminated. That's extremely short-sighted, and it's taking, you know, eliminating the people whose job it is to take care of our children.
So what should we be doing? I mean, you know, in looking at this, what should we be doing? I mean, I understand you don't close these centers. Keep these in place. And, what should we be doing, though?
You know, and frankly, the legislature decided that. So part of why there's this injunction with the Supreme Court is that in, you know, 1996, during the Ridge administration, they wanted to privatize these. And so the legislature passed a law that said you must, you know, maintain all of the state health centers that are open as of today. And so, you know, it's also an example of the Corbett administration, again, you know, acting first and getting approval later, you know, just like, you know, leasing the turnpike. It's like, so, you know, there is a law on the book that says you cannot close these health centers. Their argument was, well, that was an anti-privatization law. Well, if you can't privatize it, you also can't just get rid of it completely. And, you know, so, you know, you have a law on the book that says they can't do it. They did it anyway. So just, you know, he's sworn to uphold the law and they didn't.
Well, I mean, that really it's the arrogance that is this administration, and really the massive overreaching. This is just another thrown onto the heap.
Right. I mean, it's like, it's extremely rare for the Supreme Court to issue an injunction to stop something from happening. But, you know, but that's what happened in this case, because they said, you know, look, you know, if you go ahead and close these state health centers and this lawsuit, you know, progresses through the system, you know, it's going to be very difficult to go back later and reverse the harm.
So what do we do? What is there anything that our listeners can do? Should we be calling people? Should we What should we do?
Yeah, I mean, you know, you should contact your state legislators, and, you know, it's like, you know, just your House members, your Senate members, and tell them, it's like, you know, you need to stand up for yourself and your authority. It's like, you already passed a law once. You need to be telling your governor to, you know, uphold the law. You know, and I'd say call Governor Corbett, but, you know, I'm not sure that's the most effective use of your time, but let's call our legislators and tell them they need to defend the laws that are on the books.
If you wanted to call him, I guess, could you find him? I mean, my problem with the guys, I call him Punxsutawney Tom, because you only see him once in every blue moon.
I guess he sees his shadow.
He comes out, he sees his shadow, he comes out for a photo op, and bang, he's gone again. But all of these bad ideas, all of the bad policy, that's what we're left with.
Right, we're left with the ramifications. We're left with, you know, people who can't go to a state health center, you know, kids who aren't sure where to go to get tested for disease, you know, parents who aren't sure where to get answers to their questions, you know, when their kids are sick, and that's a shame.
A lot of what this governor and these Republicans have done is a shame. But I'm glad to see that this has happened, that the injunction at least temporarily has halted their plans to close these health centers, and I hope that we can fight that back. Kevin, I appreciate your time.
Yes, thank you.
Thanks so much, Kevin Hefty, Vice President of SEIU HCPA. Quick break, right back, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Your thoughts, questions, comments, back after this.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. The man who sends the investor class.
Just for the hell of it, let's reimagine Walmart. Imagine if the world's most profitable retailer were to invest a tiny piece of its corporate bottom line in a global effort to elevate its human moral line. And imagine if Walmart did this by committing to a sincere, enforceable, legally binding effort to ensure that its thousands of garment workers will no longer die in hellish factory fires and collapses of shoddily constructed sweatshops. Also, let's imagine that the corporation's executives reached out to union leaders and workers' rights advocates to help make this safety effort more than a PR puff piece. Oh, one more. Imagine that the executives and the multi-billionaire owners of Walmart felt good about this little gesture of common decency, maybe even took pride in it. But no, that wouldn't be Walmart, would it? Yet, while the retail giant flatly refuses to be part of it, such an effort at real reform is being made. Some 70 clothing chains, mostly major European stores, are having about 1,000 Bangladeshi factories that make apparel for them thoroughly checked by independent fire and safety inspectors. Working with unions and government officials, every dangerous facility will be immediately shut down. The companies will be responsible for financing safety renovations, and they will pay workers while their factories are closed for repair. Walmart, Gap, Target, most other big American chains that profit enormously from the old slipshod factory system have pigheadedly rejected the comprehensive safety plan as too costly. Instead, trying the PR approach, they'll soon propose a voluntary, non-binding paint-and-patch safety scheme. This is Jim Hightower saying, just once, just one time, couldn't Walmart do something just because it's right? Who knows? Doing the right thing might even prove profitable.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
Stop paying high interest rates for the promise of small rewards. Get the PSECU Visa card instead. No games, no gimmicks. Just a low 9.9 annual percentage rate. Then get the greatest reward of all, paying less for the things you want. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best.
At PSECU, we've lowered our rates just in time for summer. Get the car you truly want with a 2.99 annual percentage rate. New, used, or simply refinance the car you already have. Choose a payment term of 6 or 7 years, which means more cash in your pocket now. Additional rates and terms are available. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. 800-LOAN-555 or visit pseCU.com/life today.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal opportunity lender.
How can we be a people that fight for America if we don't know who America is or what we're all about? This is, in my opinion, a conscious effort on the part of the left, who has a huge influence on our curriculum, to desensitize America to what American values are, so they're more pliable to the new values that they would like to impose on America.
Well, I'm sure Tricky Ricky not thrilled with our Attorney General, Kathleen Kane, who has said she's not going to get into the whole Defense of Marriage Act thing. She's not going to use state resources. In fact, she's saying this is a step in the right direction, equality for all, and the Republicans losing their minds. Not happy. In fact, you know, if you saw the press conferences and the grandstanding and all the things over here in the Capitol, Thumping the chest, oh, we're going to pass laws, we're going to do a bunch of stuff. On the state level, they're talking about expending a bunch of taxpayer resources to defend what, on the federal level, Republicans have walked away from. In fact, if you remember, the House Republicans have been using taxpayer money to pay for their defense of the Defense of Marriage Act, which they rammed through. In fact, they spent about $2.3 million of taxpayer dollars. Their attorney, this Paul Clement, he has withdrawn from a case of service members suing the military for same-sex benefits because the House Republicans are just walking away from it because they know it's over. They've lost. Now, are they going to fundraise off of this? You bet. And what I find interesting is, I find extraordinarily interesting, is it's the Supreme Court that they wanted, the conservative Supreme Court. And I love when the conservatives put out, and I've gotten tons of these press releases and all of these emails fomenting about how the Supreme Court, you know, they don't believe in marriage. And this is their Supreme Court. This is the conservative majority. And I've said for years, because I have friends who, they vote solely on religious grounds. Abortion, gay marriage. The issues that, I got to be honest with you, they're far down on my radar screen. On the gay marriage front, you know what? If two people want to get married, God bless them. And if you're a guy and a guy walks up to you and asks you to marry him, be glad he didn't shoot you. You can always say no. It's a free country for now. The abortion thing, if you're against abortion, don't have one. To me, they're very simple situations. But what they've done is they've waved this shiny thing in our face that we focused on that while they're robbing us blind. It's not even picking our pockets. It is robbing us blind. It's backing the Brinks truck up to the back of the bank and just offloading every single dime. While we're still focused over here, still focused on the issues that really aren't going to go away until we grow up as a society. You know, the old man always told me, don't worry about me, worry about yourself. And I try and live by that. What you do, what consenting adults do within the confines of their four walls, what people do with their lives, as long as it doesn't affect me, as long as it doesn't affect my family, I don't really care. You know, I look at this and I think of all the resource and all the time and the energy. The abortion issue, for instance, which I don't talk about often. But the abortion issue, all of the money, all of the time, all the effort, all of the fomenting and the all of that. Had we spent that kind of effort and that kind of energy into trying to, one, educate so that you prevent, and two, create an environment where people want to bring children into this world, I think you'd see the number of abortions drastically reduced. The problem is you look at this economy. Who wants to bring children into this economy? Who can afford it? Education costs are through the roof. Food prices are going up. Gas through the roof. You know what's not? Wages. And you think as inflation goes up, and they keep telling us that the inflation isn't happening, I'm sorry, it is. Gas prices are going up. Food prices are going up. Everything seems to go up except the wages. And I sit and I look at this and I go, you know, had they spent that kind of energy creating an economy that people would want to bring kids into, this would be a much better country and a much better world. But instead, we've got a handful of people who keep us divided with these issues so that we don't focus on what's really, really important in my view, which is supporting your family, which is being able to get health care when you're sick, having a retirement when you get old. See, those are the real important issues. That's where my vote generally goes. Who has the best economic policies? who's going to benefit working people? Look, the billionaires, they've got their lobbyists, they've got their henchmen. Who's going to help you and me? Who's going to help us? It's, you know, it's just one of those things that grabs me and says, you know, we need to be working on these problems. And what did the Republicans come up with on Monday? You know, the House Majority Policy Committee Chairman, Dave Reed, said that they're going to go out and they're going to have a listening tour or some kind of weird tour, empowering opportunities, gateways out of poverty. And you know what this is going to be. These are Republicans going around. They're going to point fingers at poor people and blame them for the situation that they're in. It's their fault. Like Ted Nugent. I don't know if you saw the Nuge is bizarre rant. You know, those poor black people. It's their fault they're poor. They're poor. It's their fault. They did it. This is from a guy who got out of serving in Vietnam by soiling. I guess soiling would be the FCC acceptable word. Soiling his drawers and not showering for a month at a time and basically looking crazy. Yeah, that's who we've got people listening to. Something seriously wrong, folks. And when I've got a Republican telling me he's going to run around the state and have a listening tour, I go, well, you want to deal with poverty? You don't need to leave your office to understand how to deal with poverty. First thing is you need to raise the minimum wage so that people going to work can afford to live. We need to solidify the safety net, not continue to tear it apart. We need to get health care to everybody. We need to make sure everyone gets an education. And for all means, by all means, stop degrading people. Stop pointing your fingers. There's some 1.5 million people in this state who live below the poverty line. 12%. And what have we seen from our Republican friends this week to help the poor? Well, we got payday lending, right? They came back simply to get payday loans to poor people. I mean, if that doesn't really send up a red flag, if that doesn't really make you raise your eyebrows and go, they did what? But I look at this, again, another court injunction, another Republican court. Our courts are very conservative in Pennsylvania. Another court decision that's gone against this administration. You go back to the Act 13 where they wanted to take local control away so the drillers can drill wherever the hell they want. Then you take in the gerrymandering. You take in the voter suppression. This, I mean, how many bites at the apple do you get? Which is why the election of 2014 for me cannot come fast enough. And, you know, it's going to be interesting for the next couple of months how the moneyed interests in this state try and remake this guy. Because over the last 3 years, nothing good. Everything, you know, while you can look at other states and, you know, as crazy as some of them have been, and they have, they're not last in job creation. We are. And yet we still can't get basic things done. I mean, even if you're a big Tom Corbett supporter, and I hope one will call, because I haven't seen what, even if you're just the biggest team sport Republican, why would you vote for this guy? There's nothing there. Oh, he balanced the budget. Yeah, off the backs of those least able to afford it. And raise property taxes on everyone in this state.
But he took the Grover Norquist pledge, Rick.
Yeah. My property taxes went up. Did yours? Let's take a quick break. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
in an ocean of red. Rick Smith.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get Class War to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, sky.
White dwarfs are the hot, dense remnants of long dead stars.
They're the stellar cores left behind after a star has exhausted its fuel supply and blown its bulk of gas and dust into space. These exotic objects mark the final stage of evolution for most stars in the universe, including our sun.
White dwarfs are tough to find because they're small. A white dwarf with the mass of our sun would be no bigger than Earth. And as we stand on Earth and look up, we can't see a single white dwarf in the sky with the eye alone. But there are many white dwarfs around us in space.
White dwarfs are born when a star shuts down. A star spends most of its life in a precarious balance between inward pulling gravity and outward pushing gas pressure. The pressure comes from the burning of atomic fuel in the star's interior. As the star ages, it first becomes a red giant, but eventually its outer layers slough off into space, leaving behind the star's core. The exposed core is the newly born white dwarf.
The white dwarf now has before it a long, quiet future. As the trapped heat trickles out, it slowly cools and dims. Eventually, it will become an inert lump of carbon and oxygen floating in space. I'm Jorge Salazar.
And I'm Deborah Bird. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
The third agency of government, yeah. I would do away with the education, the commerce, and let's see. I can't. The third one, I can't. Sorry. Oops.
It was labor. That's what he was looking for. It was the Department of Labor. I thought it was interesting, and I still love that clip, and I think I always will. That's one of those moments where, you know, when you've got Ron Paul throwing you a lifeline, you know you're in trouble. But it was the Department of Labor he was looking for. And the reason I bring that up is, well, today, Thomas Perez was confirmed as the Secretary of the Department of Labor, which I got to be honest, I was really surprised that the Republicans capitulated on that and gave in. And it'll be interesting to see in the coming days what happens with the NLRB appointments if they hold to their word and give Obama his an up or down vote on the nominees that he has put forth. I got to be honest. I'm still waiting. I don't know that they're going to hold true. I'll be surprised. I won't be shocked, but I'll be surprised if they hold true. Anyway, welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, download the podcast there at the website, or get the Stitcher app on your smartphone, iTunes as well. Big news in Detroit today, though. And it's one of those moments where, you know, as I'm reading through the story of the czar of the emergency manager, the appointed dictator, whatever you want to call him, of the city of Detroit, saying, you know, we're going to go through Chapter 9 bankruptcy. I found it interesting. One of the stories that came across with it is that the attorney representing Detroit's general retirement system and the police and fire retirement system, he evidently agreed to a five-minute delay, I guess, to meet with the governor. I'm quite clear on that. But in the time that he was waiting for the governor, or waiting for, for this response, the state went in and beat him to the punch, filed the paperwork, and the judge could not issue the restraining order to stop the Detroit bankruptcy. She wanted to, according to reports, The county judge, Rosemary Aguina, she said, you know, got there as quick as we could. Obviously not in time. It was my intent to grant your request to hold back on this. Now, what I liked, what I found interesting, the governor, Rick Snyder, it's the tough love stuff. And, you know, I got to be honest, you know, when I read this, well, you know, the city's population's declined, so it's, you know, it's tough love. You know, we got to tighten our belts, tighten our bootstraps, all that stuff. He basically said, you know, I've reached the conclusion that this step is necessary. After thorough review of all available alternatives, he said he authorized the necessary step as a last resort to return this great city to financial and civic health. The decision comes in wake of 60 years of decline of the city. And, you know, over the 60 years, you know, Detroit was the fifth largest city in the country at one point. In 1950, they were the fifth largest city, population about 1.8 million. Today, it's about 700,000. And when I look at this, this is another one of those moments where you go, I could picture myself at the Bush Library being the decider again and given 2 minutes to decide this massive crisis and with a whole bunch of distraction. This is the result of 60 years of deindustrialization. As we gave power to these big multinational corporations, they did what big companies do. We're going to find the cheapest, most exploitable conditions we can find. And as a nation, we pursued them, that level of thinking, on a policy level. And these trade agreements, and it brings me back to these really insane trade agreements, where we have given our manufacturing base away. And this was, you know, I guess it's because I grew up in the 80s, and I remember Ronald Reagan. I remember the rhetoric, we're going to move from a dirty, you know, industry, we're going to move from dirty industry to, you know, white-collar, service-based economy. We're all going to work in offices, and we're all going to be neat and clean, and everything's going to be wonderful. And, well, we are a service-based economy. Are things great? Because I got to be honest, I look around and I see the Bush Mission Accomplished banner could be used by Reagan, because we're living the Reagan dream. This is a service-based economy. This is a free market economy. Deregulation has run rampant. And in fact, we've deregulated and re-regulated to push small business out while solidifying the top positions of these big multinationals. And of course, giving them huge tax subsidies and loopholes and all that, you know, just for the privilege of working there. And I look at this and I go, you know, when will we wake up? I mean, right now they're negotiating the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement. Another one of these job-killing trade agreements. I mean, we seem to be the only ones dumb enough to say, okay, yeah, take our industrial base. And you go, well, you know, is it that we're dumb, or is it that we have different priorities? And I would argue that the people who negotiate these agreements have much different priorities than you and I have. Because if you look at all the trade agreements, it's really about the wealth class. It's really about protecting the global citizens, the handfuls, the wealth. And to me, you know, having come back from this labor history tour that we did across country, it's nothing new. We've just moved it to a high-tech version of it. You know, at the beginning of the 19th century, at the beginning of the 20th century, they invented, you know, the National Guards. Why? Well, you got to put down those workers. You got to put those people down. Keep them in check. And now we've got these trade agreements that keep money in check, protecting assets. Wall Street, fat and happy. Yet you look at the jobs that are left, you look at the jobs that we have in this country and the ones that we've lost. What's wrong with us? And for me, I guess it's part of an education process of maybe just thinking a little differently. When they throw these trade agreements out at us, and I remember the argument over NAFTA. I was opposed to NAFTA. I've been opposed to all of the free trade agreements. Because we're the losers in those. And I'm not talking about just us as a nation. I'm talking about us as workers, as people who get up every day and punch the clock and have to go to work and support our families and are living paycheck to paycheck. And so many people, one, two, three paychecks away from serious financial problems. You look at the foreclosure crisis. I mean, that really highlighted for me just how precarious most families are perched. And if you can't take a day off, if you can't afford to miss a day or miss a week of pay, the boss knows that. Gotcha. So instead of raises, what we got were credit cards. And I look at these trade deals and, you know, I look at Detroit. And the sad thing about Detroit is, you know, I remember that being a thriving place. When we drove through the last time, just a couple of weeks ago, where just about every other house was condemned or boarded up, where entire neighborhoods were abandoned. How did we let this happen? Well, we let it happen because a couple of things. The free trade agreements are a huge part of it, but also beggar thy neighbor economic development. All of those jobs that left the city, just like here in this area. How many jobs have left this area for the South or for Mexico or for China or for Vietnam or wherever they're going? And we say, well, it's the free market. The market decided. The market didn't decide. A handful of rich people decided where they could make more profit. Because we don't have a tax code that encourages them to stay here. We have a tax code that says, hey, as much as you can pocket, good for you. And I remember the go-go 80s.
The one who has the most toys when he dies wins. Greed is good.
What's it gotten us? Has it gotten us a better education system? Has it gotten us a better place for our families, a better communities? Has it gotten us any of that? I'll tell you, as we drove across the country and we saw a lot of these blighted communities, I'd say no. Absolutely not. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, the RickSmithShow.com, that's where you go to get the podcast, Stitcher for your smartphone. If you've got any questions, comments, whatever's on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. Or give us a call here at the studio, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. I got to tell you, this is just mind-blowing stuff. Quick break, right back with Hour 2.
You're a proud defender of the working class majority. Rick Smith.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
Last year, 120,000 people over the age of 60 in the United States of America had their Social Security payments garnished because of student loan debt. It is a multi-generational crisis. And anybody who has, you know, sweated over their sons and daughters' student loan payments knows that it's not just about students.
¶¶ You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka says a shimmer of light has broken through Republican obstructionism in the U.S. Senate with a deal to move forward on votes for some of President Obama's nominees. In a statement, Trumka said, quote, "A confirmed National Labor Relations Board will provide millions of workers with real protection of their rights to organize and bargain with their employers," end quote. But the price of moving to votes on the other nominees was the withdrawal of two of Obama's current nominees for the National Labor Relations Board, Sharon Block and Richard Griffin. Hundreds of residents of Chicago's Brighton Park neighborhood met Wednesday to voice concerns over school budget cuts and school closings. The residents are concerned about these cuts and want the budget restored. Patrick Brosnan is executive director of Chicago's Brighton Park Neighborhood Council. He says Mayor Rahm Emanuel should make finding enough money for public education a priority.
But at the same time that they're declaring these budget cuts, Rahm Emanuel is saying that they're going to give almost $100 million to public dollars to finance a basketball stadium for DePaul University. It's crazy. So the argument that there's no money is a false one. There is plenty of money. This is about priorities.
The National Association of Professional Law State Agents, NAPAA, affiliated with the labor union OPEIU, is supporting a former Allstate insurance agent to determine if the company willfully violated state statutes in Minnesota in its attempts to terminate him and other Allstate agents in that state. Jerry Dolesky, a former Allstate agent, filed suit charging that the insurance company violated a Minnesota law and illegally expelled him. The Minnesota Department of Commerce investigated Allstate over Dolesky's dismissal and charged that Allstate had violated the statute. The National Association of Professional Allstate Agents says that Allstate agreed to pay a $5,000 civil penalty in lieu of facing formal proceedings on the charges. Jim Fish, executive director of the association, says that nationally the struggle continues as Allstate agents organize to improve their work lives at Allstate.
You know, you see in every labor management type of situation, Allstate likes to pretend that we don't exist, but, you know, obviously we do, and we let them know about it from time to time.
New York State is predicting lower health care premiums for individuals who purchase on their own. In a Wednesday announcement, Governor Andrew Cuomo said rates could drop as much as 50% on average, thanks to competition through an exchange New York created under the Affordable Care Act. There will be a number of plans to choose from, and the cost of each plan will be determined by what is offered as well as annual earnings. The drop in insurance rates won't impact individuals who receive insurance through an employer. However, tax credits are being made available for small business owners.
The Workers Independent News is brought to you with support from the Bank of Labor, a division of Brotherhood Bank and Trust, member FDIC, equal opportunity lender. Union-owned, union-represented Bank of Labor offers a business Visa card with no annual fee and points earned with every purchase, along with rental vehicle and travel accident insurance. Online at bankoflabor.com.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Last year, 120,000 people over the age of 60 in the United States of America had their Social Security payments garnished because of student loan debt. It is a multi-generational crisis. And anybody who has, you know, sweated over their sons and daughters' student loan payments knows that it's not just about students. It's about all of us.
Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. So according to the Congressional Budget Office, the plan that the House Republicans and the Senate Democrats have come up with on this student loan situation, that on July 1st doubled. I mean, went from 3.4 to 6.8% because they couldn't come up with an agreement sooner. According to the Congressional Budget Office, if this passes over the next 10 years, the government would gain about $184 billion. That means that the students are going to pay an additional $184 billion. I think I have a problem with this. Anyway, here to help us work through the proposal, where this is going, and hopefully what we should be doing is Jay Henderson. He's Democracy for America's political director. He's been running the campaign on the student loan situation. Jay, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me.
So I look at this proposal, and as I read it yesterday, I got to be honest, I thought it was they were just tying the loan rate to the Federal Reserve, to the Treasury bill, bond, Treasury notes. That's not the case, is it?
No, it's not just tied to that. You're lopping some on in addition to it. It's pretty incredible that we can go into negotiations and end up with a bill that's going to make rates go even higher than when they doubled.
So help me with this, because how much do we loan money to the big banks in this country for? Well, when the Federal Reserve loans money, how much do we give big banks? What interest do they pay?
So that's at a cool 0.75%.
And how much are we talking about potentially charging a high school student who's going to go to college for the first time and maybe be the first in the family to go to college and get an education and try and be part of the middle class? What are we charging them?
So with the cap of this proposal, it could be as high as 8.25%.
So I guess we could say that we favor banks over students.
I think that's fair to guess based off this bill. I mean, we at Democracy for America have been working hard to support Senator Elizabeth Warren's bill, which, as you said, would set up the same deal for students that banks get to enjoy. But that doesn't seem to be the direction that the Senate wants to head right now.
I mean, for me, this seems like a serious, a screw job. I mean, I look at... We've set up a situation in this country where there's no industrial base left. A high school kid, he's not going to go get a factory job. He's not going to be able to go find those jobs that generations past were able to get. They almost have to go to college, and they almost have to get that next series of years of education just to get the most menial, reasonable paying job in this economy. And yet, we're going to saddle them with a massive amount of debt just to do that?
Yeah, that's what it's looking like. I mean, the latest figures have shown that student loan debt is now over $1 trillion. It's surpassing credit card debt. And, you know, what everyone's told, going to college, getting a good education, the ability to get a good paying job out of that, you know, that's something that's just becoming less and less accessible for working families across America. And certainly this is a terrible deal for students. Just looking to saddle them up with more and more debt and making education that much less accessible.
Yeah, I saw a number the other day that said, you know, so the average undergraduate, someone with a four-year bachelor's degree, comes out of college with somewhere in excess of $27,000 in student loan debt. And I'm going, you know, you don't even have a job yet. And now you're saddled with $27,000 in debt that now they want to put as high as 8.5% interest on. That just seems to me to be, I don't know, just flat wrong.
Yeah, you couldn't be more right there. And it just boggles the mind that the deals we're seeing are not looking to make college more affordable. Again and again, Republicans have insisted that these bills actually generate profit, that they're seeing this as a method to pay down the debts that they've managed to accrue. So it's just mind-boggling that, again, after negotiations, we're ending up with a worse bill, and we're ending up with a bill that's looking to make profits off of students trying to get a higher education.
I mean, I would laugh if it were funny, but, you know, we didn't raise taxes, and we didn't pay for a war. Two wars, we ran that up on the credit card, but kids wanting to get an education, we're gonna charge them as high as 8.5% interest. And beyond that, I mean, as a parent, I've got three kids, I'm looking at this going, if, let's say I wanted to take out loans, instead of saddling my kids with the loans, I'm gonna say I'm gonna take them on. As high as 10.5%.
Right, and I think that gets to a great issue in that, you know, this isn't just students. This is the families that they're looking to start after they graduate. This is their parents who need to try to support them as well. This is a drag on our entire economy.
And I look at this and I go, you know, because I remember, you know, when I was, you know, 20, 22 years old, you know, I had some student loans. They, you know, I paid them off within a couple of years. I think I had like $4,000 back in the late 80s. And I remember going, wow, this is a huge debt. I cannot imagine. I can't fathom what it's like to not have a job, end up at the bottom of the totem pole with that kind of a burden around your neck and on your back. And the other part of it is, what's it going to mean to our economy as we move forward when the next generation can't buy houses, can't buy cars, can't start a family? What's it going to mean for the future there?
I don't even want to think about it. And I know a lot of students are going to be faced with some really tough choices of whether getting in higher education is something that they can still pursue. Because, you know, as you said, suppose that you're even lucky enough that with these rate increases, you can still get it done. You can still go to school. There are long-reaching consequences. I mean, we put together a little student loan calculator to go through the different proposals, and you're looking at it, and, you know, based off of a relatively low loan and, you know, relatively high monthly payment, we're seeing people continuing to, assuming you're taking a loan out now, continuing to make those payments 20 years, 30 years, 40 years from now. That's just crushing anyone's prospects for buying a house, buying a car, really kind of establishing themselves or making it into the middle class.
Let me tell you this, Jay, you know, as I see it, and this is a very simple thing for me. I see, since we have given away through our insane trade policies and our and all of the globalization that's gone on, we've allowed these big multinationals to flee this country and manufacture elsewhere, the need for higher education, the need for that next generation of really smart people has never been greater. And in the defense of national security, in the defense of our national interest, to me, the next generation going to college is part of national security. And it's not something that we should be saddling them with debt on. It's something that we should be paying for, just like we do K through 12. I know right now they're trying to figure out how to profit from that. But I think the next 4 years after high school should be part of compulsory education, just because that's the way things are going in this country.
Absolutely. And this, I mean, I think this is really a question in terms of where our priorities are and what kind of economy we want to build in this country. Are we going to be able to invest in students, giving them an opportunity to really kind of make a better life for themselves? Are we going to bring in innovators with new ideas? Or are we going to continue to support Wall Street and the corporations that have crashed our economy over and over again? And, you know, as we said, they're the ones that are continuing to get the sweetheart deals. It's students who are being asked to pay. You know, students who can't afford to go to college on themselves, they're the ones that are being asked to pay more, not the corporations that are hiding away their money, not the Wall Street banks who keep on crashing our economy.
Yeah, and I keep hearing this over and over. We need market-based solutions. And it drives me nuts every time I hear it, because anytime I see a market-based anything, it basically means, you know, squeeze your cheeks because you're getting something. And I look at this and this situation here, 4 points over the Treasury rate. Is that what I'm getting? 4 points over?
Well, the negotiations are still going on. Last I saw, there hasn't been an official bill introduced. I was seeing 2.5, but that's still, I mean, it's what's so heinous about this is it's a classic bait and switch. You know, that means that rates would look somewhat similar for students taking out loans this year, but it's not going to take long before those skyrocket right up to 8.5%. And that's just frankly going to make college no longer an option for so many young people and all people, anyone looking to get a higher education.
Well, so, are we creating another bubble? I mean, I look at this and, you know, just from the face of it, you go back to the mortgage crisis where we were giving people, you know, loans at, you know, at virtually nothing to get them in. And then over time they expanded, they ballooned to where nobody could pay them. Is that what we're creating here? We're getting kids saying, here, this is what the rate's going to be today. But hey, in the next couple of years, it could balloon and you'll never be able to pay it. And oh, by the way, if you can't pay it, we're going to garnish your wages until you die.
I think there's no question that there is a higher education bubble, and I don't think anyone wants to be around when it bursts, because we're seeing loans becoming that much more inaccessible. We're seeing college tuition prices skyrocket, and all this is resulting in more and more debt. And it's just going to shackle a new generation of individuals with such massive debt that's going to what defines them for the rest of their life. So I think you're absolutely right. I think we are looking at a bubble.
So how do we stop this? What are you guys doing? What are you suggesting people do? What do our listeners do?
Absolutely. So there are already senators who are speaking up against that, whether that's Senator Warren, whether that's
Senator Sanders.
Absolutely, you can count on him. So we need to pick away, because there are some senators who see what a disastrous bill this is looking like. So I would encourage each and everyone listening to give a call to your senator, talk to them why this is such a bad deal. I mean, we see a lot of momentum building around this, but no matter what, this is not going to be the end-all, be-all fight, because this is just one part of the puzzle that is trying to make higher education accessible for everyone. So we need to have these conversations about how can we make college more affordable? How can we help those individuals who are already saddled with so much debt and help them either refinance or figure out ways to pay that off or get rid of it? And this is this piece of how can we make loans actually affordable for individuals. So we need to tell Congress this is a bad deal. We need to work to stop it, but we also need to know that this is going to be a fight that continues on, and we're going to keep pressuring until we get a deal that's actually going to make a college affordable for everyone.
Yeah, and for me, the national conversation has to be had on, is this something we should just be funding, and that everyone who can do the work and can get through should be afforded the ability to do, the opportunity to do it. If they've got the ability, they, dollars and cents should not preclude them from getting that education.
That's absolutely right. And there are some interesting proposals being taking place on the more local level. You know, Oregon just authorized a study on a pay it forward system that would be slightly different than what we've grown accustomed to. So I think there really is this thirst for change, because what we're doing now is just unsustainable. So we're going to have to keep having this conversation, keep putting on the pressure, and making sure that we can really fundamentally change how we think about education in this country.
I'm right there with you. Jay Henderson, I appreciate the time. It was great talking with you.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much. Jay Henderson, Democracy for America's political director. Going to take a quick break. Back with your thoughts, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Together, we can make America better. The Rick Smith Show.
Just for the hell of it, let's reimagine Walmart. Imagine if the world's most profitable retailer were to invest a tiny piece of its corporate bottom line in a global effort to elevate its human moral line. And imagine if Walmart did this by committing to a sincere, enforceable, legally binding effort to ensure that its thousands of garment workers will no longer die in hellish factory fires and collapses of shoddily constructed sweatshops. Also, let's imagine that the corporation's executives reached out to union leaders and workers' rights advocates to help make this safety effort more than a PR puff piece. Oh, one more. Imagine that the executives and the multibillionaire owners of Walmart felt good about this little gesture of common decency, maybe even took pride in it. But no, that wouldn't be Walmart, would it? Yet, while the retail giant flatly refuses to be part of it, such an effort at real reform is being made. Some 70 clothing chains, mostly major European stores, are having about 1,000 Bangladeshi factories that make apparel for them thoroughly checked by independent fire and safety inspectors. Working with unions and government officials, every dangerous facility will be immediately shut down. The companies will be responsible for financing safety renovations, and they will pay workers while their factories are closed for repair. Walmart, Gap, Target, most other big American chains that profit enormously from the old slipshod factory system have pigheadedly rejected the comprehensive safety plan as too costly. Instead, trying the PR approach, they'll soon propose a voluntary, non-binding paint-and-patch safety scheme. This is Jim Hightower saying, just once, just one time, couldn't Walmart do something just because it's right? Who knows? Doing the right thing might even prove profitable.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction?
AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Democrats in the Senate are terrified that in 2014, the next election, 20 Democrats are up for election, 10 of whom are in very Republican states. If they try and raise taxes, if they shut the government down because they're having a hissy fit that they insist on their little tax increase and that they'd rather shut the government down than not get their tax increase, the Democrats will get wiped out in the Senate in 2014.
I think it's interesting. That's an interesting statement he made. It's been the Republicans in the Senate, though, who've caved. I mean, you look at these nominations, you look at them backing off of the filibusters, because I think people realize that what's gone on in Congress is that the Republicans have had a little hissy fit, to use a Grover word, and they are the ones who have really gummed everything up. They're the ones who have been the wrench in the wheel, who've grinded our government to a halt. And I think the realization has come forth that, you know what, they've done enough. You can't completely stop the functioning of government without people noticing. Just a thought. Just a thought. It'll be interesting to see how this plays out in the next several days. The student loan thing, though, just, you know, I've had a number of conversations with people over the last couple of months about this, because as July 1st was coming along, I was going, hey, we're set to really screw these college kids who just wanted to, the American dream, man. They just wanted to be like their parents, a chance. And we've saddled them with this debt, and then we're going to double the rates on them? There's something wrong with that. So now you've got this. Now they're trying to figure out, you know, how do they bail themselves out from this? And it's a bipartisan. This is both Democrats and Republicans who've come up with this. Not as many Democrats. I'm waiting to see the final vote on this, especially in the Senate. But I look at this and I go, you know, it really to me does highlight the fact that we need to have a national conversation of what it is that we want for the future. You know, do we want to have a well-educated workforce? Do we want to have an economy that's workable? And I fear, and I've read a number of reports on this, where we've saddled this generation with a lot of debt, and they're not buying houses or starting families or buying cars or all of that stuff because they don't have the money. And we had better think long and hard about how we make it so this next generation gets jobs, because they're one of the higher unemployment rate groups. How that we get some loan forgiveness so that they can use some of that income to start families and buy homes and all of this stuff to keep the economy moving. We better have a long conversation about this. And much like we did in the past around K through 12, around, the primary years. Should we make it compulsory? Should we make it that you have to go on to college or you have to go on to some type of job training or some type of advanced education? I'm not opposed to 2 years, lengthening the years of saying, okay, well, you know, once you turn 18, you've got a couple of options. Some type of service, some type of, vocational training, some type, or college or whatever. But giving that next generation the skills and the ability without saddling with debt, to me that seems reasonable. It just does. I'd be interested in your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. You can also email me, Rick, at therickSmithShow.com. Our mayor in Harrisburg, Linda Thompson, who is one of the members of the, she's actually a charter member of Mayors Against Illegal Guns. She called for the other day, people to join in on Saturday's rally. Saturday at noon, the march and rally will begin on the State Street Bridge in Harrisburg, and it will then go all the way to the Dauphin County Courthouse, where they'll have, you know, speakers and all of that. I think it's important to get out, and we're going to try and bring the kids, and see this. What I find interesting about this is, you know, in this state, we have these shoot first laws. They call it the Castle Doctrine here. It's not the stand your ground stuff. But it's still this idea of, you know, this mentality of I'm going to shoot. And the other day, yesterday, one of the women who's lost her son in the Sandy Hook shooting, Francine Wheeler, she lost her six-year-old son, Ben. I didn't lose her. He was murdered. But she testified in front of the, there was a hearing here in Harrisburg, and she testified. She said, you know, when this happens to you, when my child was murdered, I no longer have the fear to stand up and say what is right and what I believe. She says, I have nothing to hide. She said her son gives her the courage to be at the hearing, to speak to the legislators, and to commit to change. And what they were talking about is, you know, expanding background checks to include private sales of rifles. Evidently now, there's nothing. I mean, you can sell rifles to anybody, and there's no way of checking who gets these. Now, of course, you know, you've got groups like Mayors Against Illegal Guns supporting expanding the background checks, and guess who's against it? Well, the NRA. And what I found out is Pennsylvania is one of the few states that has its own background check system for gun purchases. Since 1998, I guess they started it, and it's run by the state police. Didn't know that. They call it the Pennsylvania Instant Check System. And what the state police say is, you know, because there are some who say, well, we should just use the federal. Here's the federal one, which I love. People who are saying that are generally the ones who say we should have states' rights, but you know, don't get caught up in the details of the hypocrisy. But the National Rifle Association people, and of course the National Shooting Sports Foundation, which I didn't know there was one of those, and there are a couple of other groups that weighed in on this. They're saying, well, you know, it would be an unfair burden to business. That's the rationale. It's an unfair burden to dealers and retailers. You know, customers wouldn't come then. And, you know, I just kind of sit back and I shake my head. I go, okay, on one hand, you've got this woman whose six-year-old son was murdered. And you've got this guy saying, well, you know, background checks are bad for business. And I'm of the mindset, you know, it's harder for me to buy a car than it is to buy a gun. Just seems a little weird. Just seems a little backward for me. And I look at these bizarre laws and the manipulation of these bizarre ALEC pieces of legislation. And there's an interesting case going on down in South Carolina where this guy broke into these people's home. He confessed to a home invasion in 2005. And he shot and killed this guy in front of an 8-year-old child. He has made the motion that he feared for his life, so he was standing his ground. Now, understand, I don't think there's a leg to stand on this, because, you know, the legislation says that, you know, you have no duty to retreat, and that you have the right to stand your ground to meet force with force, including deadly force. When you read that, what force with what force? It makes me wonder what type of maneuvering is going to happen out of all of this. You know, I think back, you know, when I was, I did the whole security guard training, and, you know, some people who take that security guard training go on to be, want to be cops. And one of the things you learn about is deadly force, and that you're supposed to meet force with force. And since that is in there, you're supposed to stand your ground and you meet force with force. I don't know that that means if someone's beating you up, you kill, you shoot them. I don't know how you get to that point. Which is why I guess I wasn't on the jury. But again, Saturday at noon on State, at the State Street Bridge, there's going to be a march and rally. And for me, the whole idea of going is against these insane laws. This is something that I really absolutely believe needs to be reexamined and repealed. You want to repeal something? There's a good place to start. As Linda Thompson pointed out, 13 homicides in Harrisburg, most of them involving stolen or unregistered firearms. Too many guns. Let's take a quick break. Right back with Bob Nay, Talk Radio News Service. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Exposing that free trade is never free. The Rick Smith Show.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
It was 75 years ago that Capital Blue Cross officially opened for business. From our earliest days, serving our customers has been at the heart of everything we do. Together we've lived history and made history. And we're here to help guide you as we navigate a new era in healthcare together. Explore affordable health insurance options and use our free online tools to search for a provider, look up treatment costs, and more. All at capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross, celebrating 75 years of service. Capital Blue Cross is an independent licensee of the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. So the righties went crazy today. Oh, it's a conspiracy. It's all this, you know, this stuff. Evidently, today was the day Barack Obama's Dreams from My Father was published. The year was 1995. On the exact same day, 70 years earlier, Mein Kampf was published. Coincidence? Well, they don't think so. And a 1 in 365 shot of getting it on that day. It is what it was. But the righties nuts out of their mind with it. You got to love when they much ado about not much. We got Bob Nay on the line, Talk Radio News Service, to find out what's going on around the world. Bob, thanks for taking time for us.
Well, thanks. I like that conspiracy theory. Wow, that was somebody was bored and did some stretching on that one.
Coincidence? I think not. Anyway, but you know, hey, you got to have something, right? If you've got nothing, you got to make some. Pull it out of somewhere. Let's get to the news. Big news on the student loans. I looked at it last night. You know, I just said what it was last night when the deal came down. I don't know that I'm thrilled with it.
I'm so happy to hear you say that, because you're only the second person today that has said that. And I right out of the box this morning when I did some radio, I just said, you know, this is nothing to do a congressional newsletter over. It has a cap of 8.25 and then 9-some percent, which means the economy gets better. That thing rolls up.
Yep.
And, yes, it did stop it from going from 3.6 up to 6 points, but, you know, it ties to 10-year Treasury bonds and then adds some 2% to that. So, you know, again, it was better than not doing it, but I don't think this one's right. Something to write home about.
No, I don't think there's anything. This isn't good at all, because, you know, when I read it last night, I said I thought it was just the House bill was just tied to the Treasury, bill. But there's that tack on, and as I read through it, they capped it for parents at 10.5%. So if I want to help my kids, so that they don't have to take out the loans, I'm going to get nailed for an additional 2%.
That's right. It's just not a good deal. I don't know. It has to go through the Senate. The House is not going to be able to abandon. They're going to have to do something. One would hope somewhere, you know, that they will tweak this thing. And because with the rising cost of tuition, again, this is not one to brag about.
Now, I guess the big question is, you know, is higher education something that, as a nation, we encourage people to go through? Is it the future of our country, or is it not? Is it worth investing in, or is it not? I mean, I think that discussion has to be had.
Well, it does, because this country is making it more difficult every single year to receive a higher education. I honestly believe that, not just the economics of it, but some of the testing. I mean, it's just become cost prohibitive, and some people are turned away at the door. So this surely is not going to give an incentive for people.
And the other part of this is that cap, that surcharge, whatever you want to put on it, that additional, I guess it's 4% above what the Treasury note is. To me, I don't know that we should be looking at deficit reduction off the back of the future, off of these kids who are told the only way you're going to get to the middle class, the only way you're going to be able to be successful in this country is to go on and take out these massive loans. I guess the average student gets out of college now about $27,000 in debt. It seems to me just to be wrong-headed.
I didn't get that one either. When I saw, you know, the bragging about $715 million in debt reduction, I thought, you know, if the government comes out awash, all right, doesn't make money, but comes out awash, it's doing something for the good of the whole down the road.
Yes.
They're bragging about not only making it harder and a flawed bill, but they're bragging about making money. And this is not one of those programs where they, you know, I can understand they want to come out a wash, again, not losing, but this was billed as, oh, it's a moneymaker.
I mean, for me, even if it came out a little bit in the negative.
Negative.
To me, that's still an investment in the future. And what we're doing to these kids, and I've met tons of them who are coming out and they're just saddled with massive debt, is, you know, we're a consumer-based economy. If you're screwing the next generation of consumers, what does that mean for your economy?
Because, yeah, it's true, because we have the manufacturing base is destroyed. So the people, like my grandparents that were glass workers, et cetera, and coal miners, they can't go do that anymore for all practical purposes. So for some, college is the only real alternative, and then it's harder to get in, harder to pay for it, and there's just no incentives to it. I agree with you.
And to highlight that, you know, 2 years ago when our governor here, the city was going to slash higher ed funding by 55%, they had a big rally that I spoke at here in the Capitol. And one of the kids that I met, as I was standing there waiting to speak, he says, you know, if this happens, I can't afford to go back to school. And not like my father and my grandfather, the factory isn't there for me. There's nothing for me to fall back to. There's no failure option for me.
That's right.
And, you know, to highlight that, you look at what's going on in Detroit. Detroit was a manufacturing mecca. It was the heartbeat of the nation, and we've given that away through globalization and our horrible trade deals.
That's correct. There's no question about that. No question.
And last question on this before we move on, you know, because one of the things that just has me nuts, and you were a Republican, I don't know if you still are or not, but when you were in Congress, what is this fascination? What is this fetish with this idea of market-based. Everything has to be market-based. So the future these kids are looking towards, their loans are market-based, which means as things get better, they're going to get socked with higher bills. That doesn't make any sense to me.
Well, I don't understand it because, again, this is not just something that's tied to a money. It shouldn't be tied to a money-making proposal. This is something for the good of the whole of the country for generations down the road. So this is one, you know, I don't think you brag about making money for the government on this or tying it to the market. This is something that's supposed to help people that literally just otherwise can't do it.
Yeah. I mean, does your party get that? I mean, I think you do, but sadly, I don't see the folks who have infected that party, I don't see them getting that.
Well, you know, I've had people criticize me recently for, you know, well, what are you a Republican for? I said, well, you know, I'm still in the Republican Party, but one of it is to, you know, have a voice to, you know, with friends at least, to try to see some change, but they don't know where they're at, and they've just got to get away from, you know, the private market does it all type of approach. But they're in flux as a party, and they just don't know where they're in particularly at. And the leadership is dry at the top. It really is. The speaker counts votes about how he's going to be reelected. So there's no policy substance debate from the top of the food chain. And that's part of the problem, I think. At least with Newt Gingrich, and people might argue this, he would actually talk issues and substance.
No, I mean, I rarely agreed with him, but you're right on that, Van. There was at least a direction, and I keep telling my Republican listeners and my Republican friends, get involved in your party and take them back to some reason of sanity, because there was a time when there was a lot the parties agreed on, and really the country agreed on. But you know, as we've seen this divide, it's just gotten too far out of hand, and no more apparent than the hearing on the IRS stuff.
Oh.
Because the news that I got originally was, the Obama's going after conservatives. When you find out is, no, that wasn't the case at all.
I would assume this will be one of the last hearings, I would assume again. Of course, I've assumed a lot of things wrong, but this one didn't produce what they wanted. Now, originally, though, the committee, which can do whatever it wants with the staff, asked a question where it got the answer it wanted, you know, were any conservatives looked at, conservative groups looked at. I'm not even going to say targeted. Well, you know, that's easy. They're supposed to look at groups and how they spend their money if they're in certain classifications, like, you know, nonprofits, etc. But the fact remains, the IG never revealed the fact that there were progressive groups that were looked at also. And that never came out. And if you say something long enough, it becomes truth.
Yep.
And unfortunately, that wasn't told. But I think today's hearing, you know, they walked away. The Republican side said, you see, but there was nothing really honestly to see. I don't know how they can have another one. It'll start to be billed as a waste of time.
Well, that never bothered them. But you know, as you said, there's no there. But you know what I wish would happen? I wish there would be a hearing on the usefulness of giving all of those tax dollars to those groups. I don't think there should be any tax loopholes for these groups. You want to go out, you want to do this stuff, you pay tax like everybody else. I'm tired of paying for all of the ideological back and forth. Pay your bill.
And there are a bunch of wealthy people. I always said this, a few rich guys, mainly males, that are trying to run the political system and are trying to get a tax break while they do it.
I mean, that's my problem. Pay the bill. That's it. Bottom line. I got to pay my taxes. You should too. Another repeal yesterday of Obamacare.
It's either the 38th or the 67th. Depends on how you want to count it, you know, but whoever let.
There were two, there's already been too many.
The thing that amazed me though, Rick, look, politically speaking, if you wanted to have a moxie on this, the Republicans, you know, if they wanted to have some moxie, they should have just focused on how to tweak the individual to come up with what the White House did, which was the, you know, staving off of the mandate for a year for the businesses.
Right.
Instead, they just did the dog and pony generic, we're going to repeal it. I think that was not a bright move.
No.
This is the 38th one. It's not going to go anywhere. I'll make a bold prediction it won't pass the Senate. So, you know, but they should have focused on the individual aspect of it. But there's also 100 ways, and I was in Congress, to torture an agency. There are 100 ways to do it. You can look at language. You can look at appropriations. If they were serious about tweaking the program, this is a dog and pony show. Let's just put it for where it is. Right. It's a dog and pony show.
Is this going to be the end of this? I mean, do you see the end of these dog and pony shows after 2014? Because, look, I think the rollout is going to be torture. I really do. I think they're ill-prepared at this point. And like anything new, I think people are going to struggle with it. But after that, I mean, after 2014, I think people will figure it out, will become accustomed to it, and it's just going to be part of our culture. At least that's my thought.
You remember the Part B debate that came up, and people freaked out. And whenever we talked about Medicare, Medicaid, they freaked out. People become so comfortable with that now. And they do. They adjust to certain things. And if the Congress comes back and fixes some speed bumps in these, because I'm not saying it was the best thing for the White House to stave this off for another year for business, but they did. But if they come back and fix components, knowing they're not going to get rid of this thing, you can't have a hybrid mess, though, where they just try to do away with it and don't fix anything. Will have bad points to it. Yeah. It will go haywire. So they just need to work on tweaking it.
I guess the question
it'll be accepted. Your point's well taken in a couple of years.
But I guess the question then becomes, in this pain period, do the Republicans continue their obstruction? Do they continue these repeal efforts and really stand in the way of fixing those speed bumps?
Well, they will, because when the individual kicks in next year and you pay 1% or you pay, I think it's a $400 fine, and once people find that is happening, then you'll see more and more and more votes to repeal to beat that dead horse. But you'll see it.
I wanted to get your thoughts on a couple of things. The Rolling Stone cover, what did you think of that?
Well, I was telling yesterday, it's a free country. They can do whatever they wanted, you know. But I thought it portrayed the kid like he was a member of the boy band on the cover of some new boy band. And, you know, what about the victims? They could have maybe even split a page. I think the Rolling Stones are, you know, trying to sell magazines with controversy. It may backfire on them.
Yeah, but I think the article was about right. I mean, how do you get a kid like this? You know, how do you turn that kid? How do you turn that kid into a monster?
Yeah, the article is, you know, he doesn't look like Osama bin Laden, et cetera. And it's just the cover took away from probably, you know, maybe they could have designed the cover in a different way or shown some of the things below it of what happened with the victims. And then it probably, but I think the story, as I understand it, you know, is not a puff piece.
No. Oh, but the thing is, I think they got exactly what they wanted out of it. They've gotten a ton of attention, and they've got people reading it.
It's like Madonna's book, remember? Yeah. People were banning it, and it's sold. I know I went out and ran and got one.
Well, how could you not? A nude Madonna, how could you not?
I was in the state senate then.
You could do that, and nobody was paying attention. The Olympics. Evidently, there's some in the Republican Party calling for a boycott of the Olympics.
Oh, Senator Lindsey Graham, who I served with in the House, I mean, I'll try to be nice. if John McCain stops short... I'll just leave it right there. He follows McCain around. And now he's come up with this Olympics thing. Don't we remember the wheat? Was it President Carter at the time? I don't know. You can't, over an incident, do this. And when I heard this suggestion today, honestly, I wanted to get a barf bag from an airplane. Seriously.
Wow.
It's just wrong. Don't do this to the athletes. You know, don't even go down that path. Russia didn't bomb us.
Yeah, okay? Good point. And lastly, I'm sure you heard over the weekend there was a little decision that happened. Curious your thoughts on the news of the little decision.
Which one?
The verdict, if you will.
Oh, the Zimmerman.
Yes.
People are comparing. You know, I've been watching with interest where people say, "Well, you know, blacks have done crimes to whites." Well, the issue of Zimmerman is different. You know, he was found not guilty of it. And so they're mixing apples and oranges. Nobody's saying that, you know, race of each side's not doing some things to each other. But I thought that right now the Attorney General, you know, can look into the laws of the, you know, use of force, et cetera, and can work at that. I kind of thought it was a strange thing when they had the free call-in toll-free number on Zimmerman, you know. But at the end of the day, I think people will have to keep calm heads and have good discussions about race versus getting violent over it.
No, I mean, for me, it's the law. I mean, at the end of the day, it's a bad law.
The president said that, you know.
It's a bad piece of legislation, and it's really changed what, you know, my view of things were. And I've said this numerous times this past week. You know, when I was a kid, you started a fight with somebody, you got your behind kicked. You got your behind kicked. Now the message out of this.
If you have a gun, you kind of feel empowered to do some things. I mean, if he didn't have a gun, would he have approached this young man?
And the other question,
probably not.
The other question is when's the NRA going to come out and say the kid would be alive today if he was carrying a gun?
Whoa, that's interesting. Yeah. That is interesting. I never thought about that.
Yeah, well, we'll see what happens. Bob, it's always great talking with you.
Thank you, Rick.
Missed you the last month.
You too. Thanks.
Our good friend Bob Nay, Talk Radio News Service. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people from the talk.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
The 19th century saw regular work weeks of 70 hours or more. Many attempts were made to get legislatures across the country to pass maximum hour laws limiting the number of hours an employee could be compelled to labor. The first union victory in capping work hours was won by the building trades in 1840. They won a 60-hour week. In 1874, the state of Massachusetts became the first to pass a law mandating a maximum hours for women. Other states followed as union activists around the country fought to pass laws to protect workers. Their work stalled in 1905 when the U.S. Supreme Court ruled the New York Bake Shop Act unconstitutional, citing a sacred bond between master and employee and the liberty of contract. With this decision, the Lochner era, named after bakery owner Joseph Lochner, who had been cited, tried, and convicted of working employees beyond the 60-hour limit, began. This single decision opened the floodgates, allowing attacks on child labor laws, minimum wage laws, as well as maximum hour laws by corporate and anti-union interests. Only after President Franklin Delano Roosevelt threatened to enlarge the United States Supreme Court from 9 to 13 did the court do an about-face with regard to liberty of contract and what has been called a switch in time to save 9, ruling in West Coast Hotel versus Parrish that Elsie Parrish was indeed entitled to the state of Washington's minimum wage, regardless of what conditions she agreed to, marking the end of the Lochner era. FDR's New Deal policies helped workers reclaim lost ground in their fight for the American dream. The proposal and passage of the Fair Labor Standards Act, federally restricting weekly hours, mandating overtime pay, setting a minimum wage, and restricting the exploitive use of child labor, was an essential step forward for workers, families, and communities. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Your proud defender of the working class majority, Rick Smith. Claustrophobia, hypochondria, xenophobia, rolled up into one. Just say in your car, stay in mind, and we won't bother anyone. Cause I'm afraid of something that's prepared to die.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. So it was today, back in 1914, that Joe Hill, the wobbly singer, was sentenced to death. Sentenced to be executed in the state of Utah. In fact, we were there in Sugar House Park where the prison was. And what I found interesting about it, it's this beautiful park now, but you stand there and you see how it could have been a really the tortured dome. But there is a piece of the Sugar House prison still left, a small part of the wall. And I found it interesting that they had hidden this piece of history behind a bunch of bushes and behind these trees where you had to actually go looking for it. You had to know there was something there to go find it. And I find it interesting that's where they stuck this piece of history. No mention of Joe Hill, and I know there's, as we found out during the tour, there's a push to have a monument, because as it's turned out, wasn't guilty. he was executed on the meagerest of evidence, but it wasn't about whether he did it or not. It was about shutting him up. And in his death and in making him a martyr, his statement, Don't waste time in mourning. Organize. That's what's been remembered. So that's a little bit of today's history. A little more fun with guns. Also today, back in 1984, and I remember this when I was in high school, a crazy guy walked into a McDonald's in California, shot and killed 21 people, wounded 19 others. He had several automatic weapons. That was one of the pushes to say, hey, you know, we need to get these automatic weapons off the street. We need to have the automatic weapons ban. Here was a guy, you know, couldn't keep a job. Serious mental health problems. How he got an arsenal, no one knows. But he told his wife when he left for the day, he said, I'm going hunting. Hunting for humans. Yeah. You want to talk about hunting? Evidently, here in Pennsylvania, they want to overturn the Sunday ban on hunting, which I didn't even know there was one, but you know, that's interesting. In Colorado, we were through Colorado on our tour, a small town in Colorado, Deer Trail, Colorado, they're considering whether to issue a hunting license that would give them the ability to hunt unmanned drones. In fact, they're talking about putting a bounty on drones. Any of the drones operated by the U.S. government, if you bring in the whole drone, $100. If you bring in parts of the drone that you shoot down with your shotgun, $25. So anyone who brings in, you know, if they've got the license, you got to have the valid hunting license. And if you bring in, you know, the whole or nearly intact drone, $100. Any of the parts, $25 a piece. So if you got the whole one, if you broke it up into pieces, you could probably make a couple of bucks off of it. Now, $100 for a whole drone, considering it cost us, the taxpayers, about $18 million each, you kind of got to wonder. Now, the guy who's the mayor of the town, a guy named Frank Fields, he was asked if he thought it was possible to shoot a drone down with a shotgun, because the law says, well, you got to read, write, understand English. You got to be 21, and you could only use a shotgun. You got to use the shotgun with a certain length barrel. The mayor was asked, do you think it's possible to shoot down one of these drones? He goes, no, it's not possible. He said, we don't intend to be paying none of that out unless we get lucky. Now, members of the town board, they think it would be a cash cow. They think that they could sell a bunch of these licenses to a bunch of drone hunting tourists. And I'm sitting there and I'm thinking, is this really what you want in your town? A bunch of yahoos coming around with shotguns shooting up in the sky? Have you ever heard of gravity? And finally, for the hour, did you know that they've got that your license plate actually tracks you now? A new report by the ACLU has found that millions of us are having our movements tracked by automatic scanning cameras on the highways that scan license plates, looking for those criminals. You go through Maryland, and I've actually got the ticket through Maryland thanks to the scanners. Some 29 million license plates were scanned and recorded in 2012, and they caught a whopping 47 people, serious crime stuff. What are they doing with all that information? And again, you know, when they talk about putting cameras everywhere, this is part of it. So get used to the police state. Where are my libertarian friends when we need them? Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, therickSmithShow.com. That's where you go to get the podcast, Stitcher on your smartphone. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Plenty of ways to interact with the program. You can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, all of that stuff right there for your entertainment, your enjoyment, and participation in the program. Quick break. Right back with Hour 3. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Rick Smith Show.
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka says a shimmer of light has broken through Republican obstructionism in the U.S. Senate with the deal to move forward on votes for some of President Obama's nominees. In a statement, Trumka said, quote, "A confirmed National Labor Relations Board will provide millions of workers with real protection of their rights to organize and bargain with their employers," end quote. But the price of moving to votes on the other nominees was the withdrawal of two of Obama's current nominees for the National Labor Relations Board, Sharon Block and Richard Griffin. Hundreds of residents of Chicago's Brighton Park neighborhood met Wednesday to voice concerns over school budget cuts and school closings. The residents are concerned about these cuts and want the budget restored. Patrick Brosnan is executive director of Chicago's Brighton Park Neighborhood Council. He says Mayor Rahm Emanuel should make finding enough money for public education a priority.
At the same time that they're declaring these budget cuts, Rahm Emanuel is saying that they're going to give almost $100 million to public dollars to finance a basketball stadium for DePaul University. It's crazy. So the argument that there's no money is a false one. There is plenty of money. This is about priorities.
The National Association of Professional Real Estate Agents, NAPAA, affiliated with the labor union OPEIU, is supporting a former Allstate insurance agent to determine if the company willfully violated state statutes in Minnesota in its attempts to terminate him and other Allstate agents in that state. Jerry Dulesky, a former Allstate agent, filed suit charging that the insurance company violated a Minnesota law and illegally expelled him. The Minnesota Department of Commerce investigated Allstate over Dulesky's dismissal and charged that Allstate had violated the statute. The National Association of Professional Allstate Agents says that Allstate agreed to pay a $5,000 civil penalty in lieu of facing formal proceedings on the charges. Jim Fish, executive director of the association, says that nationally the struggle continues as Allstate agents organize to improve their work lives at Allstate.
You know, you see in every labor management type of situation, Allstate likes to pretend that we don't exist, but, you know, obviously we do, and we let them know about it from time to time.
New York State is predicting lower health care premiums for individuals who purchase on their own. In a Wednesday announcement, Governor Andrew Cuomo said rates could drop as much as 50% on average thanks to competition through an exchange New York created under the Affordable Care Act. There will be a number of plans to choose from, and the cost of each plan will be determined by what is offered as well as annual earnings. The drop in insurance rates won't impact individuals who receive insurance through an employer. However, tax credits are being made available for small business owners.
The Workers' Independent News is brought to you with support from the Bank of Labor, a division of Brotherhood Bank and Trust, member FDIC, equal opportunity lender. Union-owned, union-represented Bank of Labor offers a business Visa card with no annual fee and points earned with every purchase, along with rental vehicle and travel accident insurance. Online at bankoflabor.com.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Standing tall against the multinational corporate agenda. The Rick Smith Show.
Back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. You know, the Employee Free Choice Act, something I think we should be bringing up again, and I think there's got to be some Democrat somewhere who grows a set. I mean, Harry Reid grew a set recently, and look what happened. They got some nominees. They got some people to fill key government positions. Look at that. Pretty amazing. Pretty amazing stuff. Anyway, today in Washington, D.C., service workers at the Union Station walked off the job protesting the federal government's failure to make sure that the people who are running these things, the contractors, pay a livable wage. It is the third strike in 8 weeks as low-wage federal contracted workers say, you know what, I've had enough already. The campaign is called Good Jobs Nation, and what they're basically saying is, look, and this is something that we should all be demanding. If we're going to use tax dollars, if we're going to use our dollars to invest in something or to have a service, it should be at a higher bar. so that we pull everybody up. Instead of saying we're going to be the leader to the race to the bottom, we're going to be the leader to the bottom of the barrel, and we're dragging everybody with us, we should be going the opposite direction. Some interesting numbers I came across. You look at the National Employment Law Project came out with these numbers, said, you know, roughly 75% of the people who work on these federal contracts earn less than $10 an hour. And 4 in 10 rely on some sort of public assistance, despite the fact that they work full time. And you look at all of the strikes and the actions we've seen across the country, in New York and in Chicago and in Milwaukee and Detroit and St. Louis and all across the country, as low-wage workers are saying, you know what? We can't make it on this. Even McDonald's, in their collaboration with Visa, trying to teach those poors how to budget their money, even they couldn't balance the budget. Had to imagine a second job, had to imagine that people can live without heat. Really just a very interesting little display that they put forth. And for me, you know, if I were in Congress, that would be Exhibit A right here. The employers are saying our employees can't make it without federal funding, without food stamps, without heating assistance, without any of this stuff. And for me, I'd be going, well, we've got two choices here. One, we can demand wages go up so people can afford to pay their bills and survive. Or we need to strengthen the social safety net and say, you know what? It is what it is. We've just got to subsidize these low-wage workers. It's a conversation that has to be had. But what we're getting is not the conversation of how do we make sure that families can survive and thrive. That's not it at all. What we're seeing is the finger pointing. Those poors, those urbans, those people, they're pulling us down. And I saw this op-ed by the woman who's the head of Americans for Prosperity here in Pennsylvania, the Koch Brother Front Group. And it was really a very interesting piece. Another one of those pointing the finger. It's them. It's always them. It's those people. She writes that, you know, nearly a third of the country, one in every three Americans receives some type of subsidized food support, some type of assistance. And I go, it's true. There are. And why is that? Not because they're lazy or they're stupid, but because the wages aren't there. And the majority of those people work for a living. But you're not going to hear her say that. In fact, you know, she does the whole divide and conquer thing. Says, you're not just feeding your family anymore. Nope, you're feeding someone else's family. They're taking money from you. And she writes it in bold capital letters, very proud, entirely too many people in this country on entitlement programs. Simply do not need the entitlement and certainly don't deserve it. And throw that entitlement on, you know, those old people and those poor people and those sick people and those children. You know, I love this mentality by these right-wingers who just throw this out. That it's all these entitlements and these poor people who are gaming the system. Not that the system's been screwing them for 30 or 40 or 50 years. No, it's not that. No. It's they're shiftless and lazy. And she goes in to say, you know, when FDR started the program, it was only for bread, rice, and milk. That was it. Bread and water for you. And she goes on to say that you could illegally sell food stamps. I've heard of it. 50 cents on the dollar. When I read that, that's what stopped me in my tracks when I read her screed. You could sell it illegally for 50 cents on a dollar. And who would do that? Considering that the average SNAP benefit is $134 a month. So what you're saying then is for about 67 bucks, you're going to sell all of your food money for 67 bucks. Is that what she's saying? And that's what she wants us to believe. And to completely forget why those programs are in place. Understand. Food stamps, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, the SNAP program, is an integral part of the social safety net in this country. Without it, in 2008, we're in depression. Without it, you've got, and I think Bush understood this, which is why President George W. Bush expanded the SNAP program, expanded food stamps, because he knew you got people hungry, you got people who can't feed their family, you're going to have people in the streets and can't have that. So I look at this and I go, you know, wow. The right emboldened now. We're going to go after those poor people and we're going to literally take food out of their mouths. Food out of the mouths of hungry children. And I looked at Congress. And Congress decided it was a good idea we're going to push forward the fraud-ridden handout program for corporations and the very wealthy. Going to make sure that the fat and happy at the very top are fatter and happier. While at the same time, cutting food stamps for people. The people who are at the margins, the voiceless, the powerless. The people who are already down, we're going to kick them some more. So the big multinational corporations who have, understand, 74% of all of the dollars in the farm bill, in the welfare bill, that goes to agriculture, goes to four companies. 74% go to four massive multinational corporations, four of them. So there are four corporate people who suck up 74% of the spending on that bill. And we're going to literally take food out of the mouths of children because, as the Koch brothers shill, says, well, you're not feeding just your family, you're feeding them. Understand, one in three people in this country are needing some help. And that's a serious problem. And you go back and you look at the numbers. And the numbers don't lie. In 2007, the percentage of the population receiving food stamps was about 8.7%. Thanks to the Bush recession, thanks to the Bush collapse, thanks to bad economic policy, thanks to wasted resource, handouts to the very well-to-do in even larger terms, that number jumped from 8.7 to 15.2 in 2007. Almost doubled. Thanks to the Bush policies. Understand what I said. Without those food programs, without that elasticity program, without that, we're in depression. Without unemployment benefits, we're in depression. Because you kept demand in the economy, you kept people fed, you kept people working. But the shills, they don't want to talk about that. And the other thing that they love to plan, it's those minorities. It's the urbans who are, and you remember Paul Ryan after the election of 2012 pointing to the urbans. It's because Obama was giving away to the urbans. Understand that half of the people who receive food stamps in this country are non-Hispanic whites. You know, as we went across this country and we looked at community after community after community, we realize there's a lot of poverty in this country. There's a lot of need in this country. And I find it utterly disgraceful that the Koch brothers shill would point the finger at the least among us, the most needy in our society, and say it's them. Instead of looking at the real problem, which is the person who signs her check, the people on the Bush Wall of Freedom, the billionaires who have systematically dismantled this nation and have done everything they can possibly do to enrich themselves at the expense of the rest of us. So I look at this and I just kind of scratch my head and ask the question, where do we go? My view is we allow workers to organize and demand, because say what you want. At the end of the day, I truly believe to my core, if you work 40 hours a week, you should be able to survive in this country. You should not be working in poverty. Now, we have a federal poverty line. And it's amazing to me that you can work 40 hours in this country and fall under that poverty line. To me, at least, the barest of bare minimums, the minimum wage, a 40-hour work week, should get you out of poverty. Don't you think? And if you go back to what I said about President Obama from the beginning, right when he took office in 2009, my number one and only wish for him would be that he would be the guy who would save the reward of work in this country. And I'm sorely disappointed. The Employee Free Choice Act didn't happen. We haven't seen a raise in the minimum wage. What we've seen is we've seen stagnation. We've seen gridlock. We've seen a Republican Party who's hell-bent on scorched earth because they understand if nothing can get done, nothing will get done. And if nothing will get done and nothing can be done, they win. The wealth class continues to win as the minimum wage continues to be eroded away by inflation and workers toil 40 hours, 50, 60 hours a week just to make ends meet and then have to suffer the indignity of asking for help and being and having a finger pointed at them by someone like a Koch brother shill. I seriously have a problem with that. Gonna take a quick break, right back. Stick around. You listen to the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Are you ready for the Summer of Solidarity Tour? Starting August 17th, a dozen union activists and our friends from across North America will be traveling coast to coast on a 17-day, 14-city road trip, starting in Philadelphia and ending in Los Angeles on Labor Day. Each stop along the way, we are going to be organizing educational events, direct actions, as well as concerts featuring the Oldie All-Stars, legendary singer-songwriter Ann Feeney, and raptivist Michael Fraser O'Brien from Kill the Autocrat. Check out summerofsolidarity.org to find out how you can help connect the grassroots.
It was 75 years ago that Capital Blue Cross officially opened for business. From our earliest days, serving our customers has been at the heart of everything we do. Together we've lived history and made history. And we're here to help guide you as we navigate a new era in healthcare together. Explore affordable health insurance options and use our free online tools to search for a provider, look up treatment costs, and more. All at capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross, celebrating 75 years of service. Capital Blue Cross is an independent licensee of the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association.
Stop paying high interest rates for the promise of small rewards. Get the PSECU Visa card instead. No games, no gimmicks. Just a low 9.9 annual percentage rate. Then get the greatest reward of all, paying less for the things you want. PSECU, financing life is what we do best.
At PSECU, we've lowered our rates just in time for summer. Get the car you truly want with a 2.99 annual percentage rate. New, used, or simply refinance the car you already have. Choose a payment term of 6 or 7 years, which means more cash in your pocket now. Additional rates and terms are available. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit pseCU.com/life today.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal opportunity lender.
Organizing America 3 hours each night. The Rick Smith Show.
And the radio is in the hands of such a lot of fools trying to anesthetize that the way that you feel. Radio is a sound salvation. Radio is clean as the nation.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, you can download the podcast there at the website or get the Stitcher app on your smartphone. Take the program on the go. You know, I look at that, just an amazing victory in Los Angeles we talked about back in January. And if you want to hear the interview with Fred Potter from back then, we've also got it at the site as well. And I said back then, look, this is going to be that moment where you go, the door's been cracked open. And someone's going to peek inside and say, you know what? Joining a union, collectively bargaining, people coming together, good for society, good for workers, good for the job place. I listen to that from $12.75 an hour up to $19.75 an hour. How long have these guys been cheated? How many years have they been getting screwed? And you listen to the conditions, just deplorable. And it's an amazing feat. And the organizing, I don't think people understand how difficult this can be, which is why I've asked one of the organizers from this campaign in New Jersey to come talk to us. Her name's Liz Williamson. She was the lead organizer for the toll campaign there in New Jersey. Liz, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks, Rick. I appreciate all the work that you're doing for the working class.
Thank you so much. You know, I look at this, and, you know, having done organizing work myself, I know how difficult it is, how time-consuming. But you got to look at this, and you go, this was worth it, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. When you see these workers starting from nothing and gaining something that's going to better their families, themselves, and their futures, words can't express the feeling that one feels.
Walk me through what did you, when you first came on this campaign, what did you find? What were the conditions? What was the sentiment of the workforce? Take me to that first day.
Well, in the beginning of the campaign, it was very difficult because these drivers were fearful of the retaliation and the retribution by the company. They didn't understand what unionizing was about. They understood that their coworkers in Los Angeles gained a contract, but they had to be educated on there was a fight. There was a fight for them in order to get where they were and that they got this contract. But they realized that by standing together as one and not buying into the company's anti-union lies and threats, that these drivers finally realized that they were successful and winning their campaign by an overwhelming majority.
So during the campaign, you know, you brought up the threats and intimidation. What kind of things did you encounter? Because, you know, I've heard the gamut of, you know, firing workers, you're threatening to fire them, you're deliberately doing things to make the job that much harder. What kind of things did you encounter there as you were going through this campaign?
Well, the effort to form a union at the Carteret facility came with a fierce resistance from the company after they hired a union buster. And this union buster, apparently, they hired him as a human resource director. And he was really union avoidance is what he was. He was a union buster. But we educated the drivers prior as to what was going to be going on, and they realized it. And shortly after about 3 weeks that this union buster was hired, the drivers filed charges with the National Labor Relations Board. And these charges included surveillance, coercion, and making threats. And those charges are under investigation by the Labor Board at this time.
And, you know, you bring that up, and immediately the light bulb goes on, and I bring it back to the political realm. And this isn't for you to comment on, but it's for me to make the observation. You go back to the political realm and why the radical right in this country is so adamantly opposed to the National Labor Relations Board, and why we've seen that this fight for the last couple of years about making sure that the board is neutered and that we can't get a quorum and a full board to make these decisions to be able to investigate these kind of charges, because that's one of the only recourses workers have against an employer who's willing to break the law and to harass, intimidate, surveil, all of that stuff.
Absolutely. You're 100% right. And these drivers, they finally realized it. They were educated on what was going to happen, and it happened. So they knew what to do at that point. And despite the anti-union campaign that was brought on by the hired union buster, These toll drivers in New Jersey, they won their election by an overwhelming majority.
Yeah, I saw
they
it. That's just 70%.
Yes,
I saw
it. They know their rights now.
And I think that's important. And you know, as an organizer, when you do that education process, you know, because I find that most people think that they have rights. One, they have rights that they actually don't, and they don't know the rights that they actually have. So there's a really an education process there to kind of do away with what they believe and what is actually the fact, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. And along with that education process comes the inoculation, where you need to tell them what's going to happen before it happens. And also, the main thing is to build a relationship with drivers.
Because
so that they can trust each other. Because
yes.
I'll tell you something, like when we first started, these drivers didn't know each other.
And
I mean,
that's,
you know, to divide and conquer what these companies want to do.
Exactly. That's by design.
Absolutely. And now they have reached out to one another. They have organized from within. We gave them the tools and... you know, we move forward. And they're going to be organizers to help us organize in the future in the ports.
That's exactly what the companies have got to fear more than anything. Because when workers start talking to each other, when they actually know their names and their families and their communities and all that, they tend to ask questions. And then they tend to want to seek solutions. If you can keep them fearful and divided and pitted against each other, that is so much better for the corporatists.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And these guys have totally been educated on the process. And we're all very, very proud of them. And
fantastic.
They're stepping up to winning their election.
You know, I tell the story quite often. You know, my wife managed a billing office, a medical billing office for a number of years before we had kids. And she said that company policy was if one employee told the other employee how much they made, they were both fired.
Oh. Well, that's typical because these guys didn't know how much each other made. And once they started finding out that the new hires were making more than workers that had been there 7, 8, 9 years, well, that's when they started exploding, not at each other, but at the fact that how could this company do this to them?
Yep. And that's why I say a contract is so important because, you know, I don't know a CEO in this country who doesn't have a contract. I think a contract's important so that everything's out on the table. Everything's laid out. Each side knows what to expect from the other. I think that is, you know, in all of my views, the contract is to me sacrosanct.
Yes. And there's one thing that I do want to point out, Rick, in this campaign, that in LA, they did not have long haul drivers that were dispatched out of LA. And one of, one of the obstacles that we faced, it was an obstacle, but it was different than in California, was that there are 41 local long-haul drivers that drive from coast to coast that are dispatched out of the New Jersey office. So we had to find a way as organizers to keep them together and to keep them involved.
Wow.
Because these guys drive from coast to coast. They live in different states. They drive all over the place. They don't know one another at all.
How'd you do that?
We devised a system of what we call, we turfed it out, and we had certain leaders in charge of certain people, and they were the ones that had to keep in contact and get to know these people. And it really, you know, helped us in this. And that way, the people, if they had a question, they know who they can go to. Other than ourselves, they always had our numbers, but a coworker.
Right.
They knew who they can go to, and they started building relationships with each other.
You know what the great thing about that is, Liz? I mean, the great part of that is now you've got those 41 cross-country drivers who every time they sit at a lunch counter or every time they get on the ratchet jaw on the CB, they're going to be talking about what they were able to accomplish, and the rest of the industry should come along because, you know, I got to tell you, it's something that's sorely needed in the trucking industry. As someone who's spent 20 years in the industry, it's something that's sorely needed because I know a lot of guys are out there struggling to make ends meet, you know, basically living in the trucks like caged animals and starving along with it. And there needs to be a groundswell, a groundswell of support of people saying, you know what, we've had enough of the sweatshop on wheels. We want to have a family life. We want to make a decent wage and support our families. You know, basically do what my grandparents' generation did 50 years ago.
Absolutely, absolutely. I so appreciate what you're doing, getting the word out. I know a lot of people that listen to your show, and it's thank you again. I can't say enough.
I appreciate it, Liz. Thanks so much. Before we take a break, I want to talk to one of the drivers, one of the heroes, one of the people who willing to step up and say, you know what, because understand, this is a multinational corporation, a huge, powerful multinational corporation. And as an individual, taking on that can be an immensely daunting task, which is why we've asked Elliot Reyes. He's one of the toll drivers there in New Jersey, also a union supporter, obviously. Elliot, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks a lot for having me, Rick.
I guess, you know, first thing, I got to be honest with you, man, hero. I mean, the bravery, the courage it must have taken to stand up and say, you know what, I'm going to support this. In this day and age, to me, you got respect from me, man.
Thanks a lot. The way I see it is, it's about time that we stand up for ourselves, you know?
Absolutely.
Working 12 to 14 hours a day, 60, 70 hours a week, and making less than $500 and struggling and not being with the family all the time, you know, it's about time we get the word out and, you know, making it better for our future, for our families.
So as I asked Liz, you know, take me to the beginning of this when, you know, because at some point, you know, I say there at some point there's only so much of you-know-what people are willing to eat. And I know a lot of people were at that point. But, you know, take me back to the beginning of this. What were your first thoughts when Liz and the organizers came to you and said, hey, you know what, look what they did in L.A. We can make things better. What was your first thought?
My first thought was go for it. I'm 100% in. When I heard what L.A. did and what they got out of it, why not us? We work for the same company, you know?
Yep. So what do you tell other folks who may be in a similar situation, you know, because – as I'm talking to people about this, this was a fairly long campaign with some intimidation, some things that, you know, people may not be all that thrilled with going through. Tell me some of the things that you encountered during this process.
I basically encountered, like, some of the drivers that they weren't, like, really for sure, you know, what they were going to do or how they're going to do it. I spoke to a lot of them myself, and I told them, you know, It's only going to benefit us. It's going to better our future, our family, you know. And a lot of them were really, you know, I don't know, you know, doubting it. And, you know, once we started talking more and more and, you know, listening to what LA got, we jumped in it. We say, hey, let's go for it. You know, we're in it for a long haul.
Good. What were the conditions like before? I mean, because I always say that, you know, it comes down to first respect. The reason people organize, first one is always respect. I want to have dignity.
Yep.
I want to have a voice. The second is generally safety. Third is generally hours, and then wages are generally far down the ladder of importance. For you, what were the conditions like? What were the things like before this?
Well, I've only been working with the company for a year. I do put in a lot of hours. You know, and sometimes I look at my paycheck and I'm like disgusted. Like, you know, the company's making it. Why can't we?
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, besides the benefits, I can't barely afford the benefits because, you know, my wife is not working. I got two kids, one in college and one in grade school, you know, and, you know, I got to do something. So I said, let's go for it.
Well, I think it's an amazing thing. What I think from this point, we need more ambassadors, more people out telling their stories, saying, you know, that, hey, we're going to make our lives better, and I wish you nothing but the best of luck in the contract negotiations and in moving forward. This is a fantastic win for you guys, I think.
Thank you.
Elliot,
I appreciate that.
Appreciate the time. Take a quick break. Back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Time to talk. We gotta do it today. No more madness for you. No more mystery. We gotta get it tonight. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show.
January of 1964 was a time to remember for many Americans. The Beatles released their first album. New York announced plans to build a World Trade Center. The Surgeon General announced smoking kills, and President Lyndon Johnson declared a war on poverty during his first State of the Union address. January 1964 was also a momentous year for the American truck drivers. The nation's truckers saw the first nationwide labor contract. The National Master Freight Agreement, covering some 450,000 truck drivers employed by 16,000 companies across the country, set a nationwide minimum wage of $3.33 per hour, or $23.63 in 2008 dollars, as well as providing health care and retirement benefits for all its members. The 1964 National Master Freight Agreement set a nationwide standard for working conditions, giving drivers a voice on the job and the power to stand up to abusive treatment, and eventually the ability to refuse to drive equipment the driver deemed unsafe. Led by labor visionary James R. Hoffa, this victory was the crowning achievement of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters as one of America's most influential unions. This landmark agreement created a framework for all national contracts to follow. Jimmy Hoffa, the man who famously quipped, "I may have many faults, being wrong is not one of them," was certainly right about the benefits, power, and influence of such a national agreement for workers, both union and non-union. Wages and benefits earned by truck drivers brought millions of hardworking men and women solidly into the middle class by rewarding hard work with a fair day's pay for a fair day's work. For generations, the National Master Freight Agreement served as the industry standard for all truck drivers, raising wages, improving benefits, and providing a safer workplace for drivers and the motoring public. Unfortunately, since the 1980 passage of truck and deregulation, the industry has resorted to cutthroat competition based on who is willing to work for less. In this environment, the National Master Freight Agreement has lost some of its power in lifting truck drivers out of low wage, no benefit, in hazardous conditions. Currently, many non-union truck drivers are earning at or near poverty wages while pushing legal limits. For many truckers, their pay is solely determined by the number of miles they drive. Breakdowns, time spent waiting to be loaded and unloaded, and other delays are shouldered by the driver, in most cases without compensation. 1964 and the years that followed has shown what can be accomplished by workers standing together. Perhaps the future will see a resurgence in worker solidarity and the reemergence of a fair day's work, a fair day's pay. This Rick Smith Show, Labor History Moment, is brought to you by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, go to www.therickSmithShow.com.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. So another organizing victory. You may remember back in January, we highlighted the fact that the Teamsters out in Los Angeles had organized the toll port drivers, a historic campaign. In fact, the first organizing campaign that anyone can find of the port drivers since deregulation. Since the Reagan-era assault on workers began, this is the first pushback. And it's exciting. What's kind of got me upset is it's taken so long, but there's movement. And now I see, in January you see Los Angeles, now I see in New Jersey the toll drivers there voted 70% to join the Teamsters, and that's why I've asked Fred Potter. He is the International Brotherhood of Teamsters Vice President and Port Division Director. He's also the president of Local 469 there in New Jersey, who will be representing those workers. Fred, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure to be on your show.
You know, back in January when we had you on to talk about the historic victory in Los Angeles, you said that this victory at Toll, our ability to negotiate that first contract that was ratified by the membership at Toll, is sending a wave through the port. You said they did it at Toll. We can do it also. You said your phone was ringing off the hook, and here we are, another victory.
Yes, that's right. And, you know, in L.A., we're working on a number of campaigns to help the drivers organize themselves and to get out of the terrible financial situation they're in. But the Toll victory also encouraged the drivers that work for Toll out of New Jersey to contact us and say they want to get a contract like that. They want to be represented by the Teamsters. And, you know, we got that done, and the votes were counted yesterday, and we're going to start bargaining.
Let's talk about that contract for a second, because I think it's important to understand exactly what we're talking about when you're talking about improving people's lives. In Los Angeles, what did you get in the first contract for those? What did those workers get by organizing?
Well, first of all, they got Teamster representation. Financially, wage rates were between $12.75 an hour to $13.25 an hour. The rate now is $19 an hour and $19.75 for the night shift, plus there's guaranteed increases the succeeding 2 years of a 3-year contract. We also strengthened and made their payment for overtime better for the drivers. We were able to negotiate them in the Western Conference of Teamsters, so they have a defined benefit pension plan.
Nice.
Now. And we significantly reduced the payroll deduction for health insurance for the drivers. There was a number of drivers who just didn't elect health insurance because they couldn't afford it with what they had to pay. That was significantly reduced, and now more drivers are taking coverage for them and their families, plus a number of other improvements in the contract that really helped to increase the standard of living for the workers. And, you know,
as I remember, Fred, I remember substantial gains in working conditions. And, you know, when I talk about, you know, why people organize unions, first and foremost, it's respect and it's a voice on the job. Then it's health and safety, and then it's wages down the road. But, you know, I remember, if I remember right, and help me here, the conditions were deplorable.
Well, I almost forgot. One of the big issues we had when we were organizing was there wasn't adequate bathroom facilities and a place to wash up, because some of where they picked the trucks up is off Toll's property. And, you know, quite frankly, the company did step up to the plate, address that issue. There is drinking water. There is clean and sanitary place for them to use during the course of the workday. So I think we made tremendous strides there, and certainly improved the working conditions, and I think the safety for the workers as well, and has been improved, because, you know, when the worker has a problem, they have somebody to go to besides just the boss, and say, listen, I've got this problem, and it's not being addressed. I think with the union now, they're able to address those issues, and we did.
Yeah, and that's a good thing. You know, the thing is, as I look at this, and you look at this Toll Group, this is a huge multinational corporation. And when you go to, and you're going to go and negotiate with the boss as an individual, good luck negotiating with a huge multinational corporation with hundreds of millions of dollars, if not billions of dollars in assets. Good luck on that.
Well, thank you. You know, we also, I don't think we would have been successful without our community partners and our environmental friends. But also the transport workers in Australia, which represents all the toll workers in Australia, have been a tremendous ally in fighting for the workers' rights here in the States. So my hat's off to them and all the other people that came out and supported the workers here.
So the people in New Jersey saw what the workers in Los Angeles did and said, hey, you know what? We should be able to do that as well, and which I think is going to spread, I hope is going to spread like wildfire, not just for the toll group workers, but for all of the port workers. And, you know, as someone who's driven a truck for years, I've been in and out of those ports. I've been in and out of rail yards. And you see a lot of these owner operators. You see a lot of these lease drivers. You see a lot of these guys who you go, they're company drivers. They're working for these companies, but they have no rights. They have no benefits. And they're basically just paid. Now, here's a per load payment, your waiting time and all that stuff. That's on you. I'm hoping this raises that up as well.
Well, what's prevalent in this industry, and not just in L.A., but everywhere you go at every port, the workers are misclassified. So the first thing the union has to do is to help these drivers is to get them properly classified. That's done by complaints with the National Labor Relations board with the State Department of Labor and the U.S. Department of Labor. And I'm pleased to say that the U.S. Department of Labor, every company that we've brought to their attention, they've investigated. They've made a determination that the employees are misclassified. They're not independent contractors. They're employees in New Jersey and in California. The Department of Labor has been pretty aggressive at looking at these companies that are cheating the workers, cheating the system, and actually cheating the taxpayers.
Help me through this, Fred, because, you know, we hear a lot of this, a lot of talk about misclassification. Exactly, you know, if I want to hire somebody and I say, well, you're just an independent contractor, what advantage does that give me over someone who wants to hire somebody? Explain the difference there.
Well, let's take it this way. You get a company like Toll in Los Angeles that properly classifies an employee, and they're going to issue a W-2. They're going to have rights under OSHA, EEOC, and all the other rights that employees take for granted. And the employer is going to pay their portion of his Social Security, payroll taxes, unemployment, disability insurance, all those things. Now you take one of the competitors to Toll who does the same thing, takes an employee's, maybe has a sham lease or leases the truck back. There's an ABC test under the IRS, which basically spells out, you know, what the standard is to determine if somebody's misclassified. But what happens is they don't pay their portion of Social Security. They have no obligation for any of the payroll deductions. That's all left on the employee. They share none of the responsibility. And it's basically said there's about a 30% financial advantage.
Wow.
To a company that misclassifies a worker. And, you know, if one of these workers who's misclassified dies on the job, there's not even an OSHA investigation on that death because he's not an employee. And, you know, if you look at the state and the community, they're not paying their share of taxes. There's no payroll deduction for taxes. They're not paying the unemployment. They're not paying the disability. And these workers lose out on basic rights that people take for granted. And the companies that do this, their justification is, well, everybody does it. That's not acceptable.
That's not acceptable. But, you know, even if you have a company who wants to do the right thing, they can't compete with these people who are gaming the system and cheating the system. And it comes back for me that our laws are fractured. They need to be updated. They need to be reworked. Because we have so many of these bad actors, or I guess I should ask, is it that you think that the laws are fractured, or that we're just not enforcing the ones that we have well enough?
I think that we have good laws on the book, but it's enforcing it, and the other is there's such a financial incentive for the companies to violate the law. What happens is a company gets found to be, misclassifying the workers, they go out of business and they pop up as another employer, with a different name, using the same scheme and scam, and depriving, the workers again of their basic rights. I think one of the things that the Toll victory did is we're seeing a lot more activity by drivers with complaints to the Department of Labor, with the California Department of Labor, the Attorney General's office, to have these employers investigated. There also has been a number of lawyers that have come out who are seeking out these drivers and saying, we can do class action suits and get you back money that you've been cheated from and get you properly classified. And quite frankly, I think a lot of this stemmed from the Toll victory that these guys are now getting the courage to say, we don't have to take this anymore.
Yeah, and I think, you know, as we see, and the reason I think this is so important is that, you know, if I'm in any industry and I'm seeing that there's movement forward, that there's organizing going on, I think a lot of people are going to want to be a part of that because I talk to a lot of people who go, you know, I'm getting cheated at work. My hours are being cut. My benefits are going up. My wages are going down. Conditions are getting worse. I'm working harder for less. All of this stuff, but at least I still have a job. If they look around, they say, well, other people are organizing and fighting back. I think, at least I hope, that you're going to get people to come along and we're going to turn the tide of this.
Yeah, I mean, we were asked by the Savannah Port Drivers, who's worked with the local union in Atlanta, to come out and to talk to them about, you know, what happened in Toll, how can we stand up for our rights here. So in June we were there, more than 300 port drivers showed up at an education forum where we had elected officials, community leaders. We had the U.S. Department of Labor there. And the enthusiasm from the drivers who said, you know, we've had enough. We have rights also. And, you know, we should share in the economic prosperity of, you know, the global trade.
Yeah.
And they want to benefit from that as well. You know, we all know that the pressure on workers to be more productive and to reduce costs, to me, in the ports, has met an extreme where these drivers, in many cases, really are modern-day sharecroppers on wheels who have no control over the economics, the hours they work, the cargo they haul, and yet they want to call them independent contractors. Just to give you a little, we met with a New Jersey legislator the other day because we passed a misclassification bill here in New Jersey that'll give drivers like port drivers, I think, a better opportunity to seek justice through the Department of Labor. And he was explaining that in his regular business is a dentist, and that what's prevalent in the industry is dental hygienists will be given 1099.
Right.
They work for the same dentist. They work their hours. They get paid from that dentist. That's all they do, and they don't work for anybody else. But a lot of people in the industry give them a 1099 instead of a W-2, and the Department of Labor has actually been cracking down on that practice in the medical field, and he felt it was a good thing. He says, here you have an employee to misclassify that person. So he was very supportive of our bill, and he could relate to it in his own industry.
Yeah, it's just not truck drivers. It's all across the spectrum. It's every industry.
Companies are looking this for a way to dodge their responsibilities to the employees, pass the cost on to the workers. And it's not a good remedy, and it's not a good future for workers.
Which is why I'm glad to see that there's someone out there standing up and fighting back, and that that we've seen another outstanding victory, and I'm looking forward to more of them. And as this continues, we'd love to have you back.
Love to, and I appreciate the fact that you spread the word and talk for the common people, the people that actually move the goods in this country and make our economy work.
Thanks so much. Congratulations on the victory. Enjoy it, but get back out there, and we want more.
Thank you very much.
Thanks so much. Fred Potter, Teamsters Vice President at Large and also the director of their port division. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. For working people from the talk.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
The 19th century saw regular work weeks of 70 hours or more. Many attempts were made to get legislatures across the country to pass maximum hour laws and limiting the number of hours an employee could be compelled to labor. The first union victory in capping work hours was won by the building trades in 1840. They won a 60-hour week. In 1874, the state of Massachusetts became the first to pass a law mandating a maximum hours for women. Other states followed as union activists around the country fought to pass laws to protect workers. Their work stalled in 1905 when the U.S. Supreme Court ruled the New York Bake Shop Act unconstitutional, citing a sacred bond between master and employee and the liberty of contract. With this decision, the Lochner error, named after bakery owner Joseph Lochner, who had been cited, tried, and convicted of working employees beyond the 60-hour limit, began. This single decision opened the floodgates, allowing attacks on child labor laws, minimum wage laws, as well as maximum hour laws by corporate and anti-union interests. Only after President Franklin Delano Roosevelt threatened to enlarge the United States Supreme Court from 9 to 13 did the court do an about-face with regard to liberty of contract and what has been called a switch in time to save 9, ruling in West Coast Hotel versus Parrish that Elsie Parrish was indeed entitled to the state of Washington's minimum wage, regardless of what conditions she agreed to, marking the end of the Lochner era. FDR's New Deal policies helped workers reclaim lost ground in their fight for the American dream. The proposal and passage of the Fair Labor Standards Act, federally restricting weekly hours, mandating overtime pay, setting a minimum wage, and restricting the exploitive use of child labor, was an essential step forward for workers, families, and communities. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center of IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Rebuilding America. The Rick Smith Show.
The walls come tumbling down. The walls come tumbling, tumbling. The walls come tumbling, tumbling down.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. Former NFL quarterback Dante Culpepper evidently lost his Florida home foreclosure. Couldn't pay the bill, evidently, underwater. There's part of me that goes, you know, it was probably so far underwater because he paid $3.6 million for it. When the bank took it back, he still owed $3 million on it. And this is a guy who made a ton of money in his years, you know, playing for the Vikings, the Raiders, and the Lions, as well as the Miami Dolphins. Sad stuff. But not nearly as sad as what would you think if you came home and you found that your house had been destroyed, had been demolished? Well, that's what happened in Fort Worth, Texas. The city of Fort Worth hired a subcontractor. And the subcontractor was supposed to go and demolish this house that had been vacant for a number of years. It was unsightly. It was something the neighborhood wanted. So they hired a subcontractor to go out and do it. And the demolition crew came out and they tore down the wrong house, wiped out the wrong house. And what I found interesting about the story is when the news crew went out to the neighborhood and said, hey, you know, what do you think? Well, the guy that they interviewed said, well, a typical city. And I go, you know, that's the trained response. Blame everything on government. Blame everything on the city. This was a subcontractor. This is a private for-profit corporation who now, I wonder what's going to happen. Because they clearly tore down the wrong house. Do they get paid by the city for demolishing the house? Did they already get paid? And are they going to be responsible for the damage that they caused? Because, you know, what would you say if you came home and your house was missing? All that was left was a big hole in the ground where the basement had been. And will they tear down the right house? Interesting stuff. But I found it really, really quite telling that the first response that the media put out, because you know they probably interviewed a number of other people, but the media report was the guy sitting there chuckling going, typical city. You know, like he knew everything. Like the city was there tearing it down. When the reality was, this is privatization. This is a subcontractor. Well, you know, tear this one down. And we've been trained like that, haven't we? Everything's, you blame everything on the evil government. It's their fault. I'm not saying government's not without fault. The government is you and me. And I would much prefer it be you and me than, well, the Shills and the Koch brothers. Just a thought. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, therickssmithshow.com. That's where you go to get the podcast. Also, Stitcher on your smartphone. If you got any questions, comments, something I said got under your skin, got on your mind, liked it, disliked it, you can always email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. I do answer all emails personally, and I look forward to the next couple weeks. Tomorrow, we're going to have Pat LaMarche sitting in for me. You may remember her from the big tour we just completed. If you missed any portion of the tour, peoplestourforamerica.com. Is the place where you pick up on any of that. Have a great night. Pat, I'll see you tomorrow.
It's coming from the wind.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@therickssmithshow.com or interact with us anytime at therickssmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show.